This is the Who Wars Network. You have made the right choice.
Look out, this Rob and the team with the Who Wars podcast. The Alex and the Force, Blue Milk and Time Lords. It's the Who Wars podcast. It's the Who Wars podcast.
Hey there, everyone, and welcome to Who Wars, episode number 40. We are the podcast for those among us who just can't decide between Star Wars and Doctor Who, and I'm your host, Rob Irwin. People, episode 40, it's a milestone in and of itself. However, there is something more special at hand today with today's podcast. If you go to whowars.net and go back to the archive section and look at the very first entry there, you'll see that the very first Who Wars, episode number 1, went out on September 7th, 2014. And the date on this episode of Who Wars, you will note, is September 6th, 2015. So we're within one day of our one-year anniversary with this episode, and that's just amazing to me. And to celebrate, Kate has put together a wonderful series of reminiscences about what we've done over the past 12 months and a number of clips. You could call it a clip show, I guess, or a clip segment at least. And that is really something special to listen to. I was quite blown away when I listened to it. Something else that blew me away is in the last 10 minutes or so before coming on here, I quickly tallied up the number of minutes we've put out there as Who Wars. And I didn't count the specials we've done. So I didn't count the Phoenix Comic Con special or the Rivers of London special or the Doctor Who Dark Journey special or anything like that. I left those aside. I just tallied up the past 39 episodes, and do you know, we've done over 4,000 minutes of entertainment. It's actually something like 4,014, but let's just call it 4,000 minutes over the last year, which I found quite amazing. And so you don't have to do the math, that's about 66 hours of entertainment over the last year that we've pumped out. And I know that initially Who Wars was a weekly show, and we're pumping things out weekly. But back in those days, we weren't doing particularly long shows. So it's really come since we've gone to the fortnightly format and started making bigger shows that I think some of the longer episodes have come into play. And we've really hit that number, that 4,000 minutes, 66 hours. It's daunting now that I look back on it, but at the time it was quite fun to do. It's a very strange thing when you put together a podcast. So, yes, here we are. It's the one-year anniversary. Kate's put together a wonderful series of clips that you'll hear in a moment. And, look, all I really want to say here at the top of the show, at least, is thank you to all of you out there for listening. Your listening is part of the reason we do this. Obviously, we'd probably do this if no one listened, because we just love talking about our pet topics of Star Wars and Doctor Who. But knowing that people are out there listening is always heartening, and it's great to hear from people on Twitter and when we get emails and so on, and we'll have another email at the end of the show, for example. It's really good to know that we're reaching out and, you know, touching other fans and being heard, and we're hearing you and having this, you know, thing they call the conversation on social media and through the podcast and so on, and expressing our fandom in ways we never could have done, you know, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, when I was making fanzines as a 12 or 13 year old. I was happy to sell my little, you know, photocopied fanzines to 5 people or 10 people at a convention, and I felt like I was reaching out and touching those 5 or 10 people, and that was amazing and special. But here through a podcast, we reach obviously so many more people, so many people around the world. When I look at the map of where episodes of Who Wars are downloaded, it blows my mind to think that there are people, you know, in Germany or Greece or, you know, some small country you would never regularly even think of, where the show is being downloaded and listened to. It's amazing stuff. It's incredibly powerful. And as the producer of Who Wars, it just gives me so much pleasure to think that we've created something that, you know, some listeners will listen to every time it comes out, every fortnight, and other people might not come to for another year yet. There might be people out there who have no idea that Who Wars exists, but in a year's time, they'll stumble across it somehow. Maybe a web link will take them there, or someone will tell them about it, and they'll come across maybe this audio, maybe episode 2, maybe episode 15, maybe episode 34, who knows? You know, and from there they might go back and listen to others. In fact, we had a chap recently on the Facebook page who said, look, I've just recently found your show, and iTunes only goes back to episode 28, apparently. It must only keep a small number. I've never actually looked into that before. And he said, are there more episodes? I said, well, yes, of course. You go to the website and you can click on the link to each episode, and there's an audio player there. You can listen to it in your browser. And, you know, so I see there are people who come to Who Wars. I don't want to use the word late, because there's probably no such thing as late when it comes to online. They've just come to it at a different time to everyone else, and then they want to go back and listen to other things we've done. Sometimes that makes me uneasy. I think of some of the early shows and things I was saying or the way I was delivering my words, and I think, oh, no, don't go and listen to episode 5 or 8 or 7 or I don't know. I'm just pulling those numbers out of the top of my head, by the way. You know, listen to the most recent stuff. Listen to the huge interviews we've done. Listen to our interviews with Colin Baker or, you know, whoever. But then I realise, well, maybe the big stuff's not what everyone's into. Maybe people want to hear the grassroots stuff. And maybe they do want to hear me stumble over my words in the early episodes or whatever it might be. It's different for everyone as to how they come to a show and how they listen to the show, where they listen to it, how they react to it, and so on. Yeah, it's an interesting topic. I could probably sit here and ramble about it for quite a while, but that would probably make for a very, very boring podcast. Look, all I'll say here again, thank you for listening, and to the team, thank you for contributing. Who Wars, as it stands today, these 4,000-plus minutes, it's not me, it's you guys. You know, I produce it, and I throw a few articles or segments in here and there. But when you look at the whole thing, it's all about you guys. It's not me, you know. I'm just the front man. I just come on at the beginning and end sometimes. Thank you, guys. Thank you so much. And without any further ado, let's kick on with our first segment, and it's going to be Kate taking us back through the last 12 months of Who Wars. Enjoy.
Hey everyone, it's Kate. So not only is this our 40th episode of Who Wars, but it also falls pretty close to our 1-year podiversary. So I couldn't let that go by unnoticed, and I decided to put together a little segment. Now it's done kind of in the style of the classic clip show, where it's going to be me narrating and then clips from highlights of the past year. So I hope you guys enjoy it. About a year ago, Rob had this crazy idea to start a podcast that combined two of the best IPs in the world, Star Wars and Doctor Who. Everyone told him he was crazy. But he persisted, and on September 7th, 2014, the very first episode of Who Wars aired.
Hey everyone, and welcome to the Who Wars podcast, the podcast for those among us who just can't decide between Star Wars and Doctor Who. My name's Rob Irwin. I have two major passions in life, Star Wars and Doctor Who. Daylight comes third.
In the first episode, Rob told us about his inspiration for Who Wars, and also his trepidations.
Now, it sounded a bit bonkers, and even now, I still can't quite believe I'm doing this, or that I have that catchy theme tune at the start that repeats over and over, Star Wars or Doctor Who, Star Wars or Doctor Who. But, you know, what the heck? Nothing ventured, nothing gained.
So Rob continued the first two episodes alone, but he quickly realized that Who Wars was way too awesome to contain it to just himself. So behind the scenes, he was sourcing out talent that would ultimately become the framework of Who Wars as we know it today.
This is episode 3, and I'm your host, Rob Irwin. And I've got to say, I'm super excited to say that this will be our first episode where we'll have more than just myself talking for the whole episode. Later in the show, we'll have Kate, who some of you might know as Kamadu on Twitter, talking about one of the Doctor Who BBC audio stories, Pest Control, which is narrated by the 10th Doctor himself, David Tennant. And we'll also have Lex, better known as Lexiness on Twitter, talking about last week's Doctor Who episode, Listen.
So with our podcast debuts, Lex and I were ready to take on the world.
Hey y'all, I'm Lex. I'm going to talk about the episode Listen.
I'm Kate, aka at Kamadu on Twitter. Every other week I'll be bringing you a review of a Star Wars or Doctor Who audiobook.
So that's what I sounded like a year ago, huh? Wow. Anyways, by episode 6, we got to do something pretty fun. Rob and Lex and me all got together for our first conference call. We did a special episode about the first half of Series 8 of Doctor Who.
This episode, however, is all about Doctor Who. Tonight, I'll be looking at the first half of Doctor Who Series 8 with my team members, Kate and Lex. Say hi, guys.
Hello.
Hey, guys.
Then November rolled along, and we saw some really exciting developments in Who Wars Land. Leo, Rob's wife, joined him for a few reviews of Star Wars Rebels. We had our very first interview on the show, which was actually a three-part series that Rob did with comic book artist Eric J. We had our Doctor Who 51st anniversary special. We had the addition of a new team member, Andy, aka The Rev.
With this episode, we have a new team member, and I'm very excited about this. And this is a team member who some of you might know if you're out there listening to Doctor Who podcasts. And that team member is The Rev. Yes, The Rev from Diddly Dum is joining us here at Who Wars.
And I did my very first interview ever with anyone, like, ever in this capacity with Ewok enthusiast David Mizejewski.
And I think it's a great example of the team starting to take on more diverse type offerings within the podcast, if I can put it that way. And that's just so exciting to me to sit back and on one hand, not have to be doing everything. That's the selfish side of it, I guess. But on the other hand, seeing the team sort of stretch out and grow and do new things on their own.
We had a good next couple of months. I covered the Phoenix Comic Con Fan Fest in December. We had some really interesting interviews and features, and the Marvel Star Wars series kicked off, so we started our first review with that. Then in December, it was time for two new team members to cover Star Wars Rebels.
Hey there everyone, it's Rob here. Look, I'm sure you want to get on to John and Alan talking about Star Wars Rebels and not hear me, you know, rabbit on. I've already spoken enough in this episode, but I just thought I'd jump in here at the start of their very first contribution to Who Wars to say how happy I am to have two new team members on and have two team members looking after Star Wars Rebels. It's definitely in good hands. I've obviously listened to this piece from them already, and I'm really looking forward to what they bring us in the weeks and months ahead. So guys, take it away.
Thanks, Rob, and welcome to Rebels Roundup. I'm Alan Zog alongside John Williams, and we're here to talk about Star Wars Rebels. We are excited about this new opportunity, Rob, to be a part of the Who Wars and to talk about Rebels. John, I'm way excited. I know you are.
Yeah, definitely. This is one of my favorite subjects to talk about these days, it seems like.
For our 25th episode special, we did something a little different. Star Wars and Doctor Who in 25 items and memories. And then at the end, Rob interviewed Doc Hume from the Diddly Dum podcast.
I'm so excited to be doing this episode, you guys, because this is episode number 25 of the show. And like 25 of anything out there in society, we're going to celebrate this episode. So for anyone who's listening for the first time to Who Wars, this isn't typically how we do an episode. All the personnel are the same, but what we're presenting this episode is different to the norm. Not unusual, just different. And what we will be doing this episode is counting down the 25 things that the Who Wars team think of when they think of Star Wars and Doctor Who. Items, memories, things that are personal to them, that sort of thing.
Here are a few of my favorites from the 25th anniversary special.
Converse high top shoes. I am referring to the 10th Doctor's classic choice of footwear.
How can you be a fan of Doctor Who and not own a pair of Converse high-top sneakers? Am I right?
One of the things that I still actually have to this day is my Empire Strikes Back blanket. It was a fleece blanket I was given, I believe, in 1981, which for me was very significant because it was one of those things that I have kept with me ever since then. I still have it, still even put it on my bed occasionally.
1977 R5-D4, one of the first ever action figures I owned. I got to thank my parents for introducing me to Star Wars at a very young age and introducing me to the toys. Action figures became a big part of my life, and it's something that I've cherished. I still have R5-D4 to this day.
You know, I've got a lot of Star Wars stuff. I've got a lot of Doctor Who stuff. And I've got a lot of love for both IPs. I wouldn't be doing a podcast on both if that wasn't the case, as you can probably imagine. But I've selected something here. It's a hardcover book. I have it in my hands as I speak. It's by Peter Haining, and it's called Doctor Who, A Celebration, 2 Decades Through Time and Space.
R2-D2. It was very clear to me from the first time that I saw the Star Wars movies that R2-D2 is the true hero of the entire saga.
There can be nothing as sacred to any Doctor Who fan than that which started one's lifelong love for the series. In my case, it was the Fourth Doctor and Leela. The first Doctor Who video I purchased was Robots of Death from a local rental store for 50p in 1990. My dad had only just got round to buying a video player, so I was keen to start a new collection. As far as I was concerned, at the age of 16, I was going to watch Doctor Who. What I didn't expect was to experience for the first time that thing when old feelings and emotions and memories flood back. Something about the music, the colours, the lighting of the story made me stand open-mouthed. I felt how I felt as a small child watching Doctor Who, and it was beautiful.
Then, of course, we had Andy's fun and creative interpretations of the Star Wars, Marvel, Darth Vader, and Princess Leia comics. So here's a few clips from some of those.
The atmosphere is electric here at the Malister Pod Race Blue Milk Cup Challenge. And just as we...
We tune to the Hoth weather station with up to the second weather updates live from Hoth. The current weather situation is snow.
We'll be bringing you more on the situation as we hear it. You're listening to Rebel Heart Radio, the transmission for all anti-Empire individuals. Keep heart. We can now confirm that the destruction of the Death Star by Rebel forces has been signaled as a major triumph against the Empire. And the shocks keep coming. Imperial Princess Leia Organa has been revealed to be a traitor to the Empire.
Standard long security tunnel, surveillance already bypassed, guns, but no visible triggers. Just an empty room. Perfectly safe to walk across, I'm sure. Let's get a second opinion from a personal friend of mine I like to call Antique Stealth Microdroid Dust. So, boys, can I get through? Just... Well, hello, 000 Personality Matrix. You are looking delightful this evening.
Dr. Aphra, I have need of you.
Now, our May the 4th episode was special for more than one reason. We had a new theme song. Plus, you know, it was our Kate Takes Over Who Wars special. So it was mostly my coverage from Star Wars Celebration Anaheim.
Of course, it would be remiss of me to end this intro without talking about our new theme music. I hinted at it in the last episode, and there it is in this episode. What do you think? Even when I heard it the first time, I was like, oh gosh, what's that?
June turned out to be another really exciting month for Who Wars. I did my Phoenix Comic Con special, which for me personally, I think the highlight of that had to be talking to Jedi Master Yoda himself, Tom Kane.
and having a Yoda off with him.
Well, I was going to save this till the end, but would you be interested in doing a Yoda off?
What is that?
Like, I do a Yoda impression. You're obviously the voice of Yoda.
Yeah, well, I'll give you a couple lines.
Okay.
The dark side.
Not bad. Not bad. After 2 days of talk, horse I've become. My Sunday afternoon. Not sound at all like Yoda. I will.
We also had the Cloud City Council podcast join forces with Who Wars to create the Who Wars Network.
This is the Who Wars Network. You have made the right choice.
Hello, what have we here?
Welcome to Cloud City Council.
I have been waiting for you.
Where our host Rob and John talk all things Star Wars.
Wipe them out. All of them.
From the comic shop to the silver screen.
And here I thought we were friends.
Everything's perfectly all right now. We're fine. We're all fine here now. Thank you. How are you?
The Force is strong with this one.
Hello and welcome to Cloud City Council. My name is Jonathan and my co-host is Robert.
Hello, everybody.
And hello, Who Wars, for our first episode on the Who Wars Network.
And then we had a really cool special, the Dark Journey special, where we got to premiere one of the new episodes for Doctor Who Dark Journey. And Rob had a really interesting interview with Andrew Chalmers, the Doctor from Doctor Who Dark Journey.
Throw the power in the balloon! It's faltering! We're going in the wrong direction! Holmes, we have no time! We are out of time!
An obvious deduction, Doctor!
We're going down! Holmes, hold on! We're losing air!
Obviously, Doctor!
Hold on, Holmes! We're going down!
You state the obvious again!
We're going down!
An icon of London, totally destroyed by myself and an alien in a balloon chased by ghosts.
We only destroyed the clock part thingy.
One does try to protect London icons, Doctor.
That's what I'm trying to do. Stick with me. Less than 18 minutes. Come on, hurry!
Hello, Andrew, and welcome to Who Wars.
Hello, hello. Thank you very much for having me. This is wonderful. I'm very excited, actually.
We also had Lex's amazing idea to mash up Star Wars and Doctor Who in whatever fashion we saw fit. So here's some clips from that.
Hello, Who Wars. It is Lex, and it is my pleasure to announce that today I get to share with you a project the Who Wars team has put together. And you're going to love it, because it combines your two favorite things, Doctor Who and Star Wars, combined into one world.
The Doctor Who and the Star Wars short stories give me ideas on how Doctor Who could be brought into Star Wars, or Star Wars brought into Doctor Who. So, let's start with the Mos Eisley Cantina. I mean, this setting is great. It's iconic, it's packed with patrons of every size, shape, colour, and sex you can imagine, and they all have stories to tell, something we learned through reading that Mos Eisley Tales book. And I'd like to see the Ninth Doctor arrive at the Mos Eisley Cantina alone. I mean, picture it. This is his first stop after regenerating from John Hurt at the end of the 50th anniversary special. And he comes in and he wanders down the bar, nodding his head a bit to the music by Figrin Dan and the Modal Nodes. And he's looking around and it's clear he's interested to be there, but he's not seeking too much of a chat with anyone either. Ironically, though, he ends up sitting next to the Tonika sisters. They're the attractive pair of human-looking women with braided hair piled up high on their heads. You see them briefly in the cantina sequence during A New Hope.
Previously on R2 Who. While embarking on a secret mission, R2-D2 encounters a mysterious alien known only as the Doctor. In need of transport to Kashyyyk, R2 enlists the help of the stranger and his TARDIS. Upon landing, R2 quickly heads to his destination, the Doctor following closely behind.
R2-D2, I hope you know what you're doing.
They continue for some time, and they see an abandoned temple in the distance. As they make their way closer, they realize the doors are wedged shut.
Well, it's a good thing those doors weren't made of wood.
And so another adventure begins in a galaxy far, far away.
Hold your fire. There's no life forms. They must have short-circuited.
That's funny. The damage doesn't look as bad from out here. Are you sure this thing is safe?
Meanwhile, in the TARDIS, the Doctor is peering into a complicated-looking telescope. We are shown that he is looking outside the TARDIS at a far-off ship, the Tantive IV. Amy walks into the control room, wearing pajamas, and stands, arms crossed, leaning on the console, looking a tad bored, but keenly observing the Doctor.
Another highlight was Andy's coverage of Hull Comic Con, and we even got to hear from the Doctor himself, Colin Baker to be exact.
Well, I was very interested. In 2005, when Doctor Who came back, we had a gritty northern actor, quite moody with a cool coat. And it did make me think, in 84, we had a gritty northern moody actor with a cool coat, because, well, tell us about the way you played the Doctor.
Well, there are several things to talk about there. Mm. The first is, when I was asked to play the part in 1983, they said, what would you like to wear? And I said, oh, do we have to have a costume? Can't I just wear clothes? You know, people did. In real life, who wears a costume? Well, maybe a policeman or a... But why should the Doctor wear a costume? Don't they have a TARDIS washing machine? So why do you wear the same thing every damn day? Doesn't it get dirty and need a wash? Anyway, so I said, can't we... of course, you know the reason why the Doctor has a costume. Because when they're wardrobe department, they have to make one for the whole series. You know, you don't have to get a new something new for them to wear.
Every year.
Well, every day.
Every day. Every day of every year you want
to see. If you're in Corrie or something like that, you have a selection of clothes, and if the story goes from one day to the next, you have to mark that by giving them something different to wear to show time has passed. Well, time passing on the Doctor. Mm. It's much easier. Keep her in the same. It's so much cheaper. One costume. That's all they have to worry about. So, on that basis, I described what I would like to wear. And it's exactly what Christopher Eccleston got.
A personal highlight for me was getting to interview Matthew Jacobs. What an interesting guy. I mean, he's worked on the Doctor Who TV movie. He wrote Young Indiana Jones, he knows George Lucas, and he wrote one of my favorite movies of all time, The Emperor's New Groove. So getting to find out the backstory behind that was definitely one of my personal highlights of the last year. First, I wanted to ask you about Emperor's New Groove.
Okay.
It's one of my favorite movies, and it's really popular with my generation. What was your inspiration for The Emperor's New Groove?
Well, the inspiration actually was shared with Roger Allers, who had directed The Lion King, and he'd been very successful with that in 1994, and I'd been very unsuccessful with my version of Lassie, but people still watch it, which had also come out the same year. He had seen the Young Indiana Jones Chronicles. I really wanted to write a big animation film.
So, that brings us pretty close to the year mark, and what a memorable and fun year it's been. So thanks to the Who Wars team for being awesome. And thanks to our listeners. We have really enjoyed all the great feedback. And a special shout out to Baz Hood. As I was going through the footage, I saw that his name showed up a lot. So thanks for listening, Baz. So thanks again to everyone who's had anything to do with Who Wars in the last year. We couldn't have done it without you. So until we meet again, allons-y, and may the Force be with you. Hey guys, it's me, Kate, and Lex.
Hello, Who Wars listeners.
We are here to pick up where we left off in the last episode of Who Wars with the Four Doctors comic series. So we're on issue number 3 right now. So the last review was me and Rob. So what did you think of issue number 2, Lex?
I liked it a lot. I liked the first one better, I think. But this one was really great, too. I think I liked it better than you guys liked it.
Wow.
In some ways. Yeah, but the art in particular, I still love the coloring that's going on. I talked about that in my conversation with Rob a little bit. Unexpected colors. Now I'm rambling, but yeah, I liked it. How did you like it?
I liked it a lot, too. I'm curious, did you concur with me at all about the likenesses of the doctors with the art, or was I, like, totally off base with that?
Oh, no, no, I do agree.
Okay.
Clara especially, and issue number 3 as well. It's driving me crazy, this whole hair issue in particular, how she goes from short hair to long hair to short hair to long hair, like with every other scene. It is absurd.
At one point, I was wondering if that is actually something important to the storyline, her hair. But then I was like, I don't know.
It's so extreme, it seriously could be, that could be an explanation.
I know, maybe. Another thing I'm wondering if it's important to the storyline is the comics that he keeps carrying around.
Oh, yeah. Well, I don't think that's going to be so important to the storyline. I think that's just Paul Cornell, you know. Oh, okay. This is a special, comic special, so we're embracing comics.
It's very
comics.
Meta.
Yes, it is so meta. I think that is meant to be a meta.
Okay. So what are your overall thoughts and impressions of issue number 3 of The Four Doctors?
Okay, so we've already talked a little bit about this, but very confused towards the end. It was very complicated.
This one is confusing. I would totally agree with that.
A lot of the explanations, the doctor is always explaining what's going on through the technicalities of this time travel stuff that we always see in Doctor Who. But this is particularly a lot of it went over my head. I just didn't know. I couldn't piece it out. It makes much sense of it sometimes.
How is it possible that the more you read something, the more confusing it gets?
Oh, yeah, man. Okay. I can't tell you how many times I've been staring at this basically all day. I'll do something for a minute, go back to it, and then do another thing, then come back to it.
Let's get into actually a page-by-page overview of this, I guess.
Yeah.
So stay with us, listeners. This is going to get interesting.
Yes, bear with us.
Okay, so what did you think of the cover? It's got your doctor.
Oh, okay. I like it, but the likenesses, again, not so much. I don't think that looks
better.
Particularly like the 11th, but hey, it's good. I like it.
Right.
To be honest, I think I've seen better covers.
Okay.
Fair enough. This whole the Four Doctors thing has been doing a sort of simplicity, just one guy on the cover feature. Like, they've done every character having a solo cover, and it's pretty equal that way, and that's cool. What do you think?
Yeah, I pretty much agree with you. It's the style of the artist and everything. I think he has very dynamic and interesting compositions.
Mm. Yeah. You talking about motion also in particular?
I wasn't, but now that you mention it, yeah.
Out from me also in that list of things you just characters you just mentioned, his motion spot on.
That's true. That is a good point. Okay, yeah. So let's get into the issue. Should we start with the little previously thing?
Previously, under attack by Reapers, our heroes fled to their fused into one TARDIS. Sprinting back through their control rooms, they staged a counterattack, shaking off the Reapers and rematerializing back in Paris in three separate TARDISes. Clara tried, again, to stop the doctors from going to Marinus, but the doctors ignored her warnings. Arriving on Marinus, they were shot at by weapons firing from outside of space-time. The perilous photo was taken at last. Their voyeuristic enemy, the Vord, who have a new leader, .. Basically, the last thing that happened in the part two was we finally saw the Vord in all their might, relishing in their mini victory of making the event finally happen. And yeah, so here we are in this first page in Planet Marinus, the desert planet, and their feet are all sunk into the sand and they're arguing.
They hear a sound, bing, an activation noise apparently. Mm-hmm. And then, dun dun dun, the immediate problem has just become lots of exploding death rays. We have Matt Smith Doctor in the foreground here. This is a full page spread and you got them all running and there's the death rays. And I definitely see what you mean about the movement, especially with this one.
Yeah. Yeah, the action shots, just movement is really cool. And I guess you could argue that they're just kind of awkward poses. Maybe that's the secret.
Yeah, that really doesn't look like Clara at all in this frame.
No, it bothers me so much.
It's the most noticeable with her, probably.
All right, yeah, okay. I love this this one-pager, by the way.
I do, too. This is one of the ones I was talking about with the excellent composition. It's just your eyes move in all the right places and everything. And, yeah. And the colors, too, are really cool. Next page.
I'm completely with you. Yes, next page. They're still running around. There's a lot of this. And I guess this has been building up. We kind of knew some kind of action-y running around would happen in this issue. So here it is.
So they're kind of like splitting up into like the different groups, like which is not their respective doctor. I like that.
I like that, too. Yeah, you finally get to see them interact.
Yeah.
And yeah, I feel like that has been something that we've been needing. That was like an obligatory situation that this issue had to have.
Mm-hmm.
Or one of the issues had to have anyways. But one thing I didn't like was this little random introduction that Alice has with Doctor.
And then he's like, Alice. Oh, I like a formal introduction. Pleased to meet you, Alice.
Hello? There are bombs coming from the sky. This is not a time to introduce yourselves. And you look way too calm for this moment.
That's true.
And it's so random.
It's like the frame before. He's like protecting her from blasts and everything. And then it's all, oh, hey.
Yeah. Doctor, I'm Alice. I need to tell you this right now. I am Alice.
Yes. So back on the previous page when he says legs, 11s. Got the one without any straight lines, you know, the school teacher one. So that'll please him. That was like a weird way to say that.
That was weird. I didn't. Is that
a British thing or something?
I don't know. What is that? I'm not familiar with that. It must be some, what's it called? Just like a common phrase, you know?
Yeah.
That was weird. It was almost like objectifying.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Okay, so let's go on.
All right, so we've calmed down a little bit in this next bit. We see the 11th and Clara get to interact. It's the 11th's first time,
right,
which is cool. I love this. They had a really meaningful moment here with the 11th Doctor all colored out in gray in the green background, saying, obviously, something huge happens in my future. It's brilliant. There's going to be another me. That's a ginormous weight off my shoulders. Mm. And if this new me is with someone as nice as you, well, he must be a very cool sort of me. Like, oh.
Aww.
Yeah. He has no idea what's ahead for him. And it's just like, oh, dude, you have no idea. It is going to be great. And you and Clara are going to be besties. And yes, you are a very cool sort of you.
So then they keep running.
They keep running. Yeah.
And or they run again because they weren't actually running.
So
they kind of stop, but
running again, these little intermittent conversations. Yes. That's a trend all throughout these issues so far, is they try to sneak in these conversations amidst action that sometimes feels a little bit awkward.
Yeah.
Do you feel that way? It's like, it wasn't quite believable. It's like they couldn't keep up the pace of the action or the conversation and mix it quite evenly. But
yeah, I can see that.
I appreciate it because, you know, I'm more about the dialogue than the action. The comics in general they kind of always have to have some kind of like kapow, you know, moments. Like, it is kind of about the action in a lot of ways. So it's hard to balance, I'm sure. And in the time constraints also, or the page limits. So yeah, like, I totally excusable, but it did feel a little bit uneven sometimes.
Yeah.
So have you seen The Keys of Marinus?
No.
Story? I don't remember this particularly, but I'm pretty sure there was a maze scene in that episode, and I'm guessing, like, this must be the same one. It's too bad I didn't have time to double-check this, but, like, okay. That's cool that they're bringing more stuff from that previous episode into the comics again.
No, so we're on to the next part. So there's, like, this maze. I haven't seen it yet, but have you seen Maze Runner?
No.
That's what it reminded me of.
Yeah, it would be. I've been told to read that book.
Yeah.
And I guess it's a movie now, huh?
Yeah. Okay, so they're all in this maze, and then they kind of, like, converge in the middle, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And they see a giant weapon.
Yeah, Rob did such a good job, and you guys,
he said that about the Daleks, didn't he?
He called it. Way to go, Rob. Woo!
He's all, it looks like a Dalek technology, yeah. And I was like,
No, I had no idea what he meant when I was listening to you guys. Like, what did I miss?
I knew what he was talking about, but I was like, but it just, that's like always, like, that's the generic kind of sight.
Yeah, like a location kind of, any kind of robot would see that. But no, actually, if I double checked this after I heard you guys, and he is spot on. It is the exact same, except it's red. Oh. It's the same vision, the same kind of target. It's definitely Dalek related. So I think the suspicion that Dalek on the ship survived is right. Oh. I mean, it's got it, right? So I don't know. I'm looking forward to what's going
to
happen.
So we don't really find out the answer to that in this issue, though, right? About the Dalek thing?
No, but the evidence keeps adding
up. Piling up. Yeah. So yeah, so it's like this bomb thing. And Claire actually says, now that looks a bit Dalek-y.
Yeah. Listen, in case people like us missed it in the number 2 issue. Thanks, Claire.
What's the girl's name? That's terrible. I can't remember my own doctor's companion's name.
Gabrielle.
It so happens. Bad. It looks like a bomb. That's probably because she's American.
I like the look of Gabrielle sometimes. Like, in this, it looks like a bomb, the most obvious statement ever. Thanks for the input, Gabrielle. But I love the way she looks. Like, but sometimes they change her face drastically. Mm-hmm. I don't know why they do that. I wish I could talk to these comic artists, because it's something they do, and they must be doing it on purpose, you know?
Or, like, they're on a time deadline, maybe.
Yeah, maybe. And they can't redo things.
Maybe.
Yeah, to keep things under budget and stuff.
Right.
But back to the bomb.
I know. So it's a continuity bomb.
Woo.
Okay, so then... Thoom!
Yeah, I love that. That's the sound it makes. Apparently, that's what the bomb sounds like, yeah. The picture above of Alice and the bright light, well done, artist team. Yes, I like that. That was cool.
Do you want to tell us what happens next?
Okay, so this continuity bomb, the way it works is it messes up the individual who is around when it goes off, the individual's timeline. So it goes back into their time, their life, and just alters little bits and makes drastic changes, obviously, because that's what happens when you mess with things like that. But we have a technicality. It's 3 doctors, so timey-wimey stuff happens. And this is where it gets complicated, isn't it?
Yep. So what do you think of that page where it's the full page and it's kind of like a spiral with the Roman numerals and all the doctors and companions and cogs and clocks and craziness. It's all exploding everywhere.
Yeah, there's a lot to look at there. The first thing it reminded me of was, I think it was one of the fan created introduction themes for the 12th Doctor.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know. Do you remember seeing that? Like, it was like a swirly clock thing. Like,
yeah,
it reminded me of that. And also you could say this is just really blunt, obvious symbolism here for time.
Time.
Like, I'm sure this is not how it actually looked like in real life, because these clocks didn't just appear, right? Unless that's how the bomb works. It just explodes in a bunch of gears. I kind of doubt it.
Maybe. Okay, so we have that massive explosion. Mm. And then we see... This is hard to explain.
Oh,
okay,
God.
So basically, they all go back in time, and they're all time ghosts, so they're kind of transparent.
This is so cool to see, yeah, transparency on a comic.
So it's the six of them. Yeah, that took some work, I bet.
It must, yeah.
Okay, so it's the six of them, and then the real-life setting that they're in is when Wilf is in that chamber.
Yeah, the chamber that requires one person.
Radiation or something, no. Right?
Yeah, there was a radiation issue.
Yes. But so we see the 10th Doctor, and instead of him going and taking Wilf's place, he just leaves poor Wilf in there.
Most horrible thing to witness.
I know. It's so terrible. I love Wilf.
Yeah. Well, one thing I didn't... which of us is more valuable to the universe? I don't want to go. So I'm not going, says mm-hmm. the 10th Doctor. And then inside, Wilf says, no, no. Why would he say no to that? He was so self-sacrificial in that moment. I felt that wasn't something.
That's true.
Said.
Maybe it just was like pain from dying. Like he's like,
maybe.
No.
No, I don't want to die.
Aww.
It's okay, Wilf.
Oh, that reminds me of that thing at the end. The little comic strip at the end with Donna. Oh.
Yeah.
Maybe
yeah.
We'll talk about that at the end. But so poor Wilf dies. And then meanwhile, they're all looking on. I have a question, though. Can the solid doctor see all the transparent doctors?
No, not until they touch, it seems like. Because that's what happens later.
Okay, so then, so the 10th Doctor, he's like horrified by seeing this version of himself let Wilf die like that. And then he's like, I would never do that. And then the 12th Doctor is kind of like, the weapon found at least one alternate timeline where you did. And then he gets all self-righteous and he's like, it wouldn't have caught me like that. And then Clara's like, you made decisions like that all the time. And he's like, I absolutely do not. I thought that was pretty good.
It's really good. Yeah, very interesting.
Okay, yeah. So then Alice has some interesting insights about... That's Alice when it's the little boxes like that, right? She says, maybe that's why Time Lords change.
Oh my God, you're so right. Wait, yes, because I went all the way back to the beginning of the comic, and you're right. These brown boxes start with Alice.
That's like her narrating or whatever, I guess. Yes.
It starts with the end of the universe. They're meant to have just caused it. So it doesn't end with a bang, but a row. That was the last time we saw the brown boxes, I think.
Okay.
So here we are again. Continue what you were saying. Okay. Sorry.
Let me start over. So she says, maybe that's why Time Lords change. So if they suffer guilt or grief, they can become someone else. And they still remember it. Only maybe it's like it happened to someone else.
It's interesting.
Yeah, I thought so.
Yeah. Normally, I don't like these little narrative boxes that often because they tend to be overly dramatic, but I actually like that. That's insightful because it's also kind of true.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
A different man.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so let's move on. So this is like the 11th Doctor's alternate timeline, right?
Well, you're looking at the one where the 10th is at a big throne, right?
Oh.
Is that the 10th? Yeah, it's the...
Oh, I thought it was...
Because, see, sometimes the facial recognition is hard.
That doesn't... Okay, yeah, I think you're right.
Oh, I know what you're about to say.
Because I thought it was going to, like, each doctor's, like...
It was, yeah. And here we are again with the 10th, and then right there it says, like, death to cruel tyrants, no regeneration, by one of the Slitheen. And the 11th Doctor definitely dies, and yet here we are... At going back just a box, is the 10th Doctor on a throne saying, bow lower, your tribute will help feed the few left who are starving. It looks like the 10th Doctor.
It does. I'm so confused. Are you confused?
What is happening? I don't know. Maybe we can figure this out now.
Okay. Let's just move on and maybe it'll make sense.
Okay. So maybe the 10th Doctor sitting on a throne and they're observing this version of the 10th Doctor. And then the 11th says, out of billions of timelines, there will have been very few where you, and then the 10th interrupts saying, very few is too many. And then the 12th, I guess, says, who are you to decide what is good? Or no, somebody else does. Who says this? Who says that? Who are you to decide what is good? Who says that?
It's not the 12th Doctor?
It's unclear. It probably is the 12th.
Yeah, I don't know.
And then this part, it looks amazing. The Sylvain killing the 11th, that looks amazing. Well, actually, everything looks amazing here.
Yeah.
The city, there's so much going on. And then that little inside box of like that purplish colored room, mm-hmm. and transparent. It's really well done, the artistry.
Okay, so the 11th Doctor gets killed
in
an alternate timeline, apparently.
Yeah, bam.
But then we go to the next page, and we find out...
There he is again.
So they're kind of confused about it, too. They're like, what? What's happening? That's what we've been saying this whole issue.
Yeah, that's what we've been saying. We're right there with you, folks.
So, yeah, so you kind of mentioned it already, but it's designed to only work on one Time Lord, I guess. But there's three of them.
That's where they explain that part.
Yeah.
This scene where the 11th is giving River Song. Sometimes I do that in my head. I mix up Melody with River.
Oh, wait. Are you on the next page?
Oh, you're still on the one before.
I just wanted to say I love the art on this page with the city, the futuristic skyline and the colors. And it's just, it's like, it's the thing with all the history happening at once, right?
It's very Star Wars-y.
Oh, that's true. That's probably why I like it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you got some pterodactyls and blimps and all kinds of craziness. Let's go on to the next page, then. So, is this a separate one for the 11th Doctor, then? Another separate alternate timeline?
Yeah, I think these are all
because he was killed. So, it's just a different one. Okay.
Yeah. So, it's this continuity bomb. The concept is very confusing.
Right. Okay, so this is April 22nd, 2011, and it's where when time collapsed, River Song refused to kill you, except she didn't, and he decided to rescue himself from that.
And I guess this explains the 11th Doctor's point in history. I guess, obviously, by his reaction saying, what? It did what? She did what? What? His reaction, I guess... He's not familiar with the that whole scenario that hasn't happened yet in his timeline. So I didn't realize that the 11th Doctor is actually so young and hasn't been through the whole Amy Worry thing yet somehow.
So we have this very domestic looking scene and the Doctor's bringing River some tea.
Yeah, not just domestic. I was surprised by the sexuality in that one.
Oh, there's that too. She's got like...
Oh, yeah. She's not wearing a bra, honey.
And the sweatshirt or whatever is like hanging off her shoulder all.
Yeah. Like, what is going on here? Bringing a cup of tea. Mm-hmm. Sure. And like River Song is like patting the couch for him to sit. Like, oh, dear Lord.
That doesn't really look like River either.
No, it doesn't. Not at all. No.
Like if you didn't know who that was supposed to be, you'd be like, who's this lady?
I mean, it looks a little bit. They got the red hair and it's curly, but.
Yeah.
Not quite.
Next page.
More transparent pictures.
Yeah, that's so cool.
It is so cool. I love this transparency effect, and it's really well done on this page.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So does anything important happen on this page?
All right. What? So if you were trapped in this timeline, the prophecy Clara found will be fulfilled. Game over. All right, so now they're talking about, like, how do we get out of this mess? And they definitely... have concluded that they do not want to get stuck in this timeline. But doesn't this timeline contradict the last one? If the previous you died...
Oh, that's like what I was saying.
Yeah, okay, so you've already talked about this a little bit.
Yeah. Okay, so how do they end up on the TARDIS then? Just, like, magically?
Oh, yeah, this one. So they faded... That's how they move about. They just kind of
randomly?
Seems. Yeah, okay. Yeah. Yeah, I got that feeling too, because they only clearly did that fade out once between mm-hmm. scenes. But yeah, that I think it must be a continuing thing. We just have to assume that that's going on still. And here they are in the 12th Doctor's, or future 12th Doctor's TARDIS. Mm-hmm. And here's another example of the facial recognition thing that kind of causes some problems sometimes. I really had to convince myself that this was the 12th Doctor. It Same. Didn't look like him. I mean, there's the obvious difference here of the beard and the gray hair.
Did you think it was maybe the War Doctor?
Yeah, that thought came through my mind. Okay. It also came through my mind.
We'll come back to that at the end, but yeah.
Yeah.
What this, it kind of is reminiscent of, like, Howard Hughes. Did you ever see Aviator with Leonardo DiCaprio? Where he, mm-hmm. are you familiar with Howard Hughes at all? He was, like, this eccentric billionaire. And basically like this, he ends up secluding himself. And, oh, his nails should be longer, though. His fingernails got all long, and he looked kind of like that. And it just kind of reminded me of that. Yeah, he's got, like, the long, bushy hair, and it doesn't really have a Peter Capaldi vibe to it.
No. I mean, but our first impression of Peter Capaldi was in a homeless person's outfit. Is that why, like, maybe? Or just, like, he's stayed in this TARDIS so long he no longer cares about putting on new clothes? Yeah, is that what they were putting? Like, making us...
I think so. I think that's the impression I got.
Yeah. So I guess that explains that, but it was hard to figure out.
So he's kind of gone mad, and he's talking about how Clara has betrayed him. And
yeah, I'm pretty sure, so I told her, go to hell, and she did. They're talking about the last of season 8.
Oh, right? With the lava and all that?
Yeah, and Clara hasn't done that yet, obviously.
Interesting insight there.
Or not with the lava. I think, you know.
Where she was throwing the keys, not that. That wasn't all. That was.
Oh, no, you're right. Yeah, that is when he says that. Go to hell. Yeah, he does. You're right. You're right. Mm. Sorry. So I guess that's when that happens. But if that is what he's talking about, then I didn't believe this scenario somehow. It just didn't. Let me see if I can get a concrete explanation to how I didn't believe it. Like, so he says he's talking about Clara and regretting these things that he said and wishing she was back, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then when they finally do touch, which I also have a confusion about how that even worked, if this is the real doctor. Well, when they do touch, he recognizes them. He says, oh, you're back. Mm-hmm. But that is that the 12th Doctor that we are well familiar with, and we've seen what happens after the whole go-to-hell conversation, and he certainly doesn't look like that during that timeline that we are familiar with. But maybe that's a result of the bomb?
Like, oh, yeah, because it's like a different timeline.
But still, he shouldn't be that extreme a version of Doctor.
Maybe it's just been a really long time.
Maybe. Maybe he never changed out of those homeless person's clothes.
Yeah.
In that different reality. I mean, I guess we could come up with all sorts of explanations, but it wasn't reminiscent enough for me. I wanted a clearer timeline.
Gotcha.
That made more sense. Yeah. They finally do touch to bring
the 12th Doctors, correct?
Oh, sorry. Yeah. The 12th Doctors. They finally touch, and that brings everybody solid again. Nobody's transparent. They're all on the same timeline. They chose that one. But it's another trap. Apparently, this 12th Doctor, despite his regrets of letting go of Clara, apparently this 12th Doctor does want to work with the, what are they called? The Vords. Mm-hmm. So it's just from a moment.
So that's how it ends then, right?
Yeah. I'm skipping ahead. Yeah, I skipped ahead. Sorry.
You didn't skip that much, actually.
Okay.
Did we even miss anything? There was that really cool scene that was, like, underwater. I like that a lot, too.
I liked that, yeah. But it didn't make sense how this 12th Doctor was very, like, a legitimate concern, being true to himself, like a real doctor would, being, you know, regretting letting go of Clara, telling her to go to hell. That is a true moment. And yet, so, like, he starts off as definitely true and ends up as totally false. Like, how does that even happen? It didn't make sense to me. I didn't believe it.
Yeah. Now, I have to say, the very last scene where it's him ripping off the mask, I thought that was the War Doctor the first time I read it.
Wait, what mask are you talking about? Sorry, what?
The last page that says to be continued.
There's Isn't a mask?
That's not a mask. What is he?
Oh my God! There's a. I'm scrolling down.
So the thing that's like that he's holding. Oh. Isn't that a mask? What is
yeah,
that?
Yeah, he's holding a mask for the board. So he's changing. It's just like we saw in the very first scene of the first issue, of that guy that died. He transferred his power of leadership to the new guy, and the armor just kind of builds itself organically on top of the person, right?
Yeah.
So that's what's happening here.
Putting it on. It's not coming off of him.
Yeah. He's putting it on.
Oh, I thought he was taking it off, like a reveal.
No, I don't think so. No, which is that would be crazy.
I thought it was, oh man, I was totally off. I thought it was the war doctor.
That would be, I feel bad. That's a horrible place to be in. That at least it's not as bad as what you thought. So I have like a couple of theories that this version of the 12th Doctor maybe isn't the Doctor and is maybe a setup because of the Daleks. And the classic series, the first Doctor at one point encounters a complete copy of himself that was created by the Daleks. And now, if they're doing a lot of flashbacks, like with the Vord and all that, the first Doctor kind of world, maybe this isn't the 12th Doctor, but a robot. So it could be a robot that looks exactly like the 12th Doctor. And I say that, I know you're probably like, what? Like, there's no sign that he's a robot. It's just, and trust me on this, episode as the first Doctor, these robots that the Dalek created to look exactly like the first Doctor were identical and looked completely human and acted and talked normally. So that's my one theory, but the only problem with that theory is that when they touched, it shouldn't have brought everybody back to reality. So I'm out of, I don't know.
That makes so much more sense. Yeah, so I thought there was actually three 12th Doctors at this point.
Yeah, three Doctors, 12th Doctors.
That is, well, I guess it's Doctor Who, anything can make sense, but yeah, what you're saying helps me immensely.
Oh, good. How about this one scene here where they're outside on the deck and the word just came out and the 12th Doctor, the raggedy 12th Doctor, how about that?
There
we
go.
Have a raggedy 12th Doctor. He says, I have seniority here, or I need to face my fear, /, or pick a reason. He's just rambling here, I guess. Like, what
He really is a madman in a box.
Yeah, he is a madman in a box. It happened. Oof, what a tragedy. Well, I mean, he's always been a madman in a box, but he's really, really a bad kind of madman in a box. I have seniority here, or I need to face my fear. Like, what are you talking about? Or pick a reason? What? And he's telling this to the group. Like, nobody knows what the heck you're talking about.
Crazy.
But let me do the talking. Ugh. I'm just confused. Okay.
Should we talk about the little thing at the end, or should we give our scores and stuff for this issue first?
Okay.
Let's give our scores and our overall thoughts for this.
Okay. Yes. Sure. Yes. I guess I'll go. I have out of 10, I'm going to give this a lower score than the first one. But it was still interesting. There was a lot that happened. They were good at packing it and all in. But I think I got a 6 out of 10 for the first. I'm going to give this like a 5 out of 10 for the
ouch.
Yeah, well, I could even go lower because, you know, I don't like
the that an overall score then
for the plot for the, okay. the writing yeah Ooh. I know, kind of low. It's only the third one, we still got two more.
Yeah
I don't know, I just had the confusion part really bugs me.
Yeah.
And if only I could talk to the writer.
Mm-hmm.
Paul Coronel, I want to talk to you. And for the artistry, 9 out of 10, because I love it. It's so great.
So for me, I'm trying to remember what I gave. I think I gave the art a 7 and the writing an 8 for the last issue. The writing's definitely going to go down this issue because of the confusion issue.
Yeah.
Let's go I think I'll go a 6.5.
All right. So you're still kind of up there. And what parts do you like about it?
The writing, you mean?
Yeah.
Well, I really liked the 12th Doctor's dialogue. That was my favorite part.
Yeah. Oh, nice. A sea of acid. Yes, I agree.
And, you know, like, some of the moments, like we talked about, were with the other companions were pretty good. So I like that. Yeah. Now, the art, I'm going to bump that one up probably to an 8. Okay. I still have the same issues with, like, the likenesses and things like that. But yeah. This one just had some really great full-page scenes that I really, really liked. They were beautiful.
I keep on forgetting that when I give the overall grade for the artistry about the likenesses.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a complicated discussion because I do think it is on purpose a lot of the time. But it has that functional issue where you really can't tell what's going on. Like, who is the person that you're looking at? That's kind of important. And it's distracting. You said the word distracting in your last conversation, and that's just how it is. It's distracting.
Okay, so before we give, like, our final thoughts and stuff, let's talk about the little comic on the back.
Yeah, Paul Cornell and Rachel Smith got together again. And
yay! This one was pretty funny, but it was also kind of sad.
Yeah.
Poor Donna.
I know. But hey, you know what this means? It means that Donna was probably going to, you know, finally be informed of her past history.
So basically it's like a support group for all the companions. And so it's got like all the girls there, a couple guys.
How many? It looks like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, like about 20?
Yeah, something like that.
Is that how many there have actually been?
I don't know.
I wonder.
But anyway, so you know, they're talking all the different companion stuff.
There are a lot that I didn't recognize, which I loved. It's given me further inspiration to keep watching the classic series.
I know. Maybe I should get on that.
Yeah. Like, Carol, like, don't we like her? Oh, we like her, don't we, Ben? Great, sure. Those two are from the second Doctor, the beginning of the second Doctor, and the end of the first Doctor.
So, yeah, so the last panel is poor Donna walking in, and she says, "Oh, sorry, am I in the wrong room?"
And you would only get that if you know Doctor Who.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it's just not funny.
That's true.
Are we, people who are like, have no idea what we're talking about, that like right now listening onto Who Wars Network and they've never seen Doctor Who.
The Star Wars fans.
Never seen this. Yeah, all the Star Wars fans be like, "This isn't funny. Why are we talking about this?"
Well, that's why we have the show notes. I can just skip to the next Star Wars segment. Okay, so let's wrap this thing up. So, final thoughts, and then what you're hoping to see in the last two issues.
Okay, final thoughts. This was confusing. What I hope to see in the future, less confusing.
Well said. I concur.
I mean, that was a huge simplification, though. We should talk more about what we want to see.
I want to see more of the War Doctor. This is four Doctors, right?
Yeah, but that is officially confirmed that on Twitter, Paul Cornell has officially stated that there is no more War Doctor.
What?
Yeah, I just saw that. I was like, damn. And also, I was having a discussion with, hey, shout out to Alan. He was listening to our Four Doctors discussion, and he brought up the War Doctor and how he's not going to be showing up. And I was like, yeah, I really wish.
Wait, okay. I think we should talk about that for a little bit. Is the Four Doctors the other 12th Doctor then?
Oh, God, yeah. What? Me? Ooh. You know, I think something really big is it's going to be just completely messing with our minds, this fourth Doctor. I have a feeling it's going to just blow us, like, did not see that coming. And
maybe the fourth Doctor is all the Doctors combined.
Gasp.
Whoa. It blew my mind.
I like that. I like that a lot. That is so cool. Yeah, they combined the TARDIS. Why can't they combine the Doctor?
Yes.
Yeah, so, okay, seriously though, we hope to see, the tangent that we were last talking about was the War Doctor, and we didn't finish that. Mm-hmm. The War Doctor is definitely not coming back, so that was maybe just something to confuse us, to make the ending even more surprising, because we're still expecting we assume that the fourth Doctor is the War Doctor.
But this Paul Cornell is just a big liar.
Yeah, it's a ploy. He's setting us up.
He's like J.J. Abrams, and he's like...
Yeah. I think that's what's happening here.
Hmm.
The War Doctor was misleading.
No, I'm really curious. But it's
It's an unfortunate misleading. Like, he really, like, he picked a very sensitive subject for us because we have been deprived of the War Doctor, mm-hmm. like, seriously deprived. And it was so great to see him be in that that role of actually being the War Doctor. And it was just so brief, so unfair. So we've given our marks, and we would like to see in the future War Doctor, but that is not going to happen.
Or is
so
it?
We would just, we would like things to be understanding, and the Fourth Doctor, this mysterious Fourth Doctor, to actually make sense. Is that what we're concluding, maybe?
One thing, I don't want to see this, but I'm kind of thinking one of the companions might die. Probably not Clara. That? I don't know. It's just a feeling I have.
Oh, my God.
Either Alice or Gabrielle.
I think it might be Gabrielle because then,
no,
like,
not her. No.
I mean, how could any of them really know what's happening? Mm-hmm. So, like, are you saying that because of what the 12th Doctor said? Like, I should have kept you? Or, like, why are you saying this? What's your theory?
I don't know. I just, you know, I keep hearing that there's, like, something really big is happening. I don't know.
Okay. You just have a hunch.
I don't know. Hopefully I'm wrong, because I like both of them.
Exciting, but sad. I don't want them to die.
Well, and then, you know, since they're both, like, they're only, both of these girls have only been in the comics.
Yeah.
So we're not, like, super attached to them, but so it would be, if Paul Cornell wanted to do something really dramatic without, like, the consequences of killing Clara off.
Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm. And they do have that conversation earlier on saying, like, somebody asked, I think it's Alice, saying, like, are they going to be okay, the doctors? And then the 12th doctor's like, oh, yeah. Oh, wait, no, it's Gabrielle, isn't it? Yeah, Gabrielle asked that. And he says, oh, yeah, he has one of you looking after him. Mm-hmm. Like, that might be a hint of what you're talking about. Like, these girls might do something drastic, like sacrifice themselves for them.
Oh, that would be so sad.
It would fit in, maybe, of your theory. Uh-oh.
Well, I guess you'll have to listen to the next review.
Yeah.
We don't know who that's going to be yet, do we? Probably. I don't think it'll be either of us.
And they get to look back on all our suspicions and ponderings and laugh at us.
Yeah. Awesome. Okay.
It's going to be great.
All okay, right. So... stay tuned for the next review coming up right now.
And we're back. Thank you, Kate and Lex, for looking at issue number 3 of the comic. I'm here with Andy. Hi, Andy.
Hello.
To look at issue number 4 of The Four Doctors. And Andy, this is your first time looking at one of these issues, so welcome aboard.
Thank you very much. Actually my first time looking at all 4 issues. I've read them in one omnibus edition.
Well, that's interesting, because that you'll have a different perspective to me, because it's been, I guess, 3 weeks since I read the first one. So reading them all in a row like that, these first 4, what's been your big picture thoughts, your overall thoughts so far?
Well, it's preferable to me looking at them as a bulk, because I do struggle with single issue comics sometimes. It's this sort of American format of having to wait and just having these installments, having to wait. I mean, with UK comics, you used to get a lot of self contained things, so I enjoyed reading it as a bulk.
Mm.
I think I might have been disappointed if I'd have read them as single issues. You see,
why is that?
I enjoyed the first issue. Most of it, I felt that the doctors having a chat in the coffee shop went on a bit too long for my liking.
Mm-hmm.
But I felt that if I'd have read the single issues, I'd have identified more spots like that where things flag, whereas reading them in one long go, you know that, well, if there's a slow bit, you know there's a fast bit about to come, and I don't have to wait for it.
Exactly.
So I think I felt a lot more comfortable like that.
Okay, cool. I guess the saving grace here is that they've only been weekly. Could you imagine having a month in between each one?
Absolutely awful, yeah.
Okay, so we're talking about issue number 4, and I guess the big reveal is, and, you know, spoilers for those of you who haven't been listening to these segments so far, the big reveal is that an older version of the Peter Capaldi Doctor is the big bad. And he's the leader of the Vord.
He is. Now, what interests me, because obviously the War Doctor's in issue one, so is the Peter Capaldi Future Doctor the fourth Doctor of the title?
Do you know,
it's not featured anymore, has he?
I was thinking this just a moment ago when I was grabbing a drink. I thought, you know, it's four Doctors, but the War Doctor was only a cameo, but we do have this other Doctor, so who are the four?
Well, I think this is his surprise, that we were led to believe that the fourth Doctor was the War Doctor, but I think that the future Capaldi is the fourth Doctor of the story.
And that makes sense, because they probably didn't want to do too much with the War Doctor, stray too far into that territory, because I guess it gets a bit murky as to what he can and can't do.
Yeah, it's a very difficult character, I think. I mean, going back to issue one, I thought it was very strangely written, because when people seem to be writing for the War Doctor, they just treat him like the Doctor, which, of course, in the duration of the episode we got him in, that he did sort of gradually become the Doctor. But he was a warrior, and he's referred to as the Doctor in that first issue, and he's just a bit too Doctorish for my liking. I think he's a difficult character to...
I think so. I mean, I've already commented in these reviews we've been doing so far that I even had a problem with him as the War Doctor in Day of the Doctor, because he was meant to be so badass, and he just wrote "no more" on a wall.
Yes.
Look at me, I'm writing on a wall. So he is the big bad of the Vord, and I've got to say, and again, this is something I've said in an earlier review, I wonder how they got the rights to the Vord, because getting the rights to the Daleks is so tricky, and I think the Vord are another Terry Nation creation. I don't know,
it depends. I mean, the BBC was a funny thing back then, but maybe they learnt their lesson with the way that the Daleks were handled, because then after that, they were, and Terry Nation was making money off the Daleks. I think the BBC were always trying to invent a new Dalek, weren't they? That's why you had the Mechanoids and the Chumblies and things that they did try marketing toys and jigsaws and things. They were looking for a marketable brand, so they may well have kept things a bit more contract based, because the Vord have appeared in Doctor Who Monthly comic before, in quite a controversial strip, because they were it was supposed that they eventually evolved into the Cybermen.
That's right. That was
Doctor story.
That was such a strange one. That came out around, I don't know, about 86 or 87. I was like 11 years old at the time, and thinking, oh, is this really what happened? Is this what I'm meant to believe now? Is this canon? I don't know.
This is it. So I don't know. I think there might be a slightly different contract with the Vord, but who knows?
Yeah, presumably so. Now, the last issue I found very interesting, that's one that Kate and Lex have just reviewed, where they had the look at all their future possible selves in different time streams and doing, you know, horrible things.
Yeah.
Including, you know, the Tenant Doctor being Time Lord Victorious and sitting on a throne and all this kind of stuff. I thought that was very cool. This issue, meanwhile, seems to be a lot of running around the Vord base. So it's, you know, I didn't find this as exciting as the previous issue in many ways.
Well, I mean, that's difficult for me to comment, because I've read them as a bulk.
True.
But this definitely was, I found that this fourth issue sort of harder to get into and read. You know, you were waiting for things to happen. It was a bit shy at the end, at the beginning, but then, yeah, a lot of running around, as you say.
Yeah.
It led to a good cliffhanger, I think, but yeah, there was a lot of running around.
Yeah, well, I mean, let's dive into that cliffhanger. Let's just go straight there. We have Alice and Gabby running away from the Vord. Obviously, people out there, if you haven't read this, they're running away from the Vord, they're hiding, and then they see the TARDIS. It's the TARDIS of the older 12th Doctor. They're going to make a run for it. And one way or the other, one of them will at least get there. And it's Alice who makes the run first and gets gunned down.
Yes. Now, this is interesting territory, really, because I know on the telly program, especially in the RTD era, they had a thing about, we'll never show a companion die, or if they do, there'll be a clever way around it, like with Rose or something like that.
Mm.
And, of course, in the original series, we had Adric and Sarah Kingdom came croppers, so it wasn't something they were shy of then. But I'm aware it is now, and they're very careful about the way they showed death, because, of course, it's that thing in it with 24-hour rolling news and all sorts of shocking images just popping up on Facebook and things, let alone on the television news. You know, death is a very different kind of thing. It looks at as a different kind of thing these days as to what it was in the past.
That's right.
But in the comic, it's quite a bold thing to do because, you know, is this the end of her timeline? We don't know. This is her last adventure with the Doctor. Well, is she actually dead, or is there going to be a timey-wimey conclusion? The only time there was something like this on the telly was when the Tennant Doctor got exterminated.
Mm.
And you knew that was going to be all right because he was the Doctor.
Exactly.
You knew there was some more episodes where, with a companion, Danny Pink, of course. I forgot about Danny Pink. They didn't shy away from that, did they?
No, that's true.
But you know, with a companion, you're a bit more uncertain. Well, yeah, they're disposable.
Mm.
Is this the end? And it sort of makes it feel, as a cliffhanger, it feels a little bit grimmer.
Yeah, well, I'm remembering back to the last time Lex reviewed an 11th Doctor comic, and it seemed to be the end of the story for, I think, the Jones companion and the Alice companion, and it seemed like a stepping off point for where he might go on to other things, the Doctor, that is. So maybe bumping her off here works in the context of the comic. Maybe they are going to have a new companion or something different for the 11th Doctor. Or they could do something timey-wimey. And, I mean, they even make jokes about, you know, timey-wiminess in this comic because there's so much timey-wiminess going on. And she'll be absolutely okay. But this panel where she's gunned down and we just see, you know, half her face and it's a bit blood-splattered and it's a very shocking scene.
It is, yeah. It is. It's a bold move, but there are a few. Yeah, I think it's quite clever having Paul Cornell write this, as he is a television writer and a comic book writer, and he's obviously completely submerged in Doctor Who lore. But he seems to really understand the sort of Stephen Moffat pulling the rug from under your feet kind of tricks that he throws into the series to sort of disorientate you. You think you know what's going on, and you think you're going to be able to predict things, but no, there's all sorts of things coming from different angles that confuse you. Yeah,
that's true. And as a comic writer as well, he knows a few comic tricks as well to throw in.
Yes. I was just thinking as well, we were talking about the Vod being in the Doctor Who monthly comic strip. I'm pretty sure as well, I might be wrong, but I'm pretty sure that when they decided to finish the Ace story, they killed Ace off as well in the comic book.
Vague memories of that, yes.
I think to remember an illustration that was very much like the Batman cover, the Death in the Family one, where Jason Todd's Robin dies, and there's a front cover of Batman holding Robin's corpse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Blood. I'm pretty sure I remember an image of the Doctor holding Ace in a very similar way. I don't know if my images are getting mixed up in my head there, but...
No, yeah, I think you're onto something.
The comic was something very different.
Yeah, and it's not that I've read that particular comic so recently, but I think in one of the Stripped for Action segments on one of the DVDs, I think there might have been that panel in one of those little documentaries on the DVDs.
Probably around on the Survival one, maybe, wasn't it? Because there was a lot about the series ending and what happened to Ace and the Doctor of that and what would happen in the next season, wasn't there?
That's right. Yeah, it could very well be there. I love that Stripped for Action series that looks at all the different Doctors in comic form. It's brilliant.
Yeah.
I guess speaking of comics, we've already spoken about Alice being gunned down. Let's talk about what happens at the end. The Doctor's parcel of comics. Gabby opens it and something happens, but I don't know what happened.
No, neither do I.
I was wondering what you were going to come out with then. I mean, she unwraps it. It's wrapped in brown paper. The brown paper falls to the floor and she says, no, no. And there's beams of light coming out. Something is happening. Ooh. And she screams. The Vord hear her screaming. And they say that was her tombstone, or her gravestone, rather.
That's right. It's going to be a trick, isn't it? It's going to be a clever trick, and this is the point. We're trying to work out a twist now, aren't we? We're trying to get the better of Paul Cornell's trickery. You know, I think we've got used to the fact that he's throwing curveballs, and we're trying to guess what the curveball is now, and I don't think we will.
Yeah, I mean, Sorry. I was going to say, my first thought is maybe she's been sucked back out of this, where they are in time, to maybe some other point where she can help. She can maybe get another doctor. Can she get the war doctor? I don't know. That could be completely wrong. But she does seem quite surprised and scared of what's happening too. So I don't know.
It's just this, the comics were referenced back in the first issue, weren't they, when he went past the newspaper stand in Paris.
That's right. He wanted to pick up his comic books, and he's mentioned them a few times.
You see, if we go back to the 11th Doctor's first TV season, where we've got that bit where he goes back through, doesn't he, the adventures and visits himself, and that's why you see him, you know, he's got a jacket on in some shots and not in others, because there's these two doctors running around, isn't there? I'm just wondering if he's done a trick like that. It's a timey-wimey trick. I wonder if he's planted something early on in the adventure that foresees the end of it. I don't know.
Are you thinking of the Weeping Angels episode with Smith?
That's the one, yeah.
Where he comes back to Amy to comfort her, but he is wearing a different jacket.
Yeah. I'm just wondering if there's some kind of trickery like that where they've played with time.
Yeah, gosh. It's it's all going to be wrapped up in one issue now. on the next Who Wars, a number of us will get on as many as we can to talk about it. I just don't know what it's going to be. It's intriguing.
No, it is. It's very interesting. It's quite a clever story.
Yeah, that's for sure. In terms of, we were talking about Paul Cornell as a writer and so on. Yeah. And I've said this in the previous episode. Do you feel this is maybe a cut above some of the other Titan storylines we've had so far?
Yeah, definitely. I think this is the best one where the 12th Doctor's dialogue's been written, because even though I review the 12th Doctor comics, I struggle with them. And in this, the last story, the Fractures one that's just been happening for the 12th Doctor, it started off in the first episode very good, because it felt like a TV episode.
Mm-hmm.
It was sort of caretaker-type grounded. UNIT were in it. It felt like one of those episodes on TV. But as the episodes of that went on, it seemed to play it too safe, whereas this one isn't playing it safe. And you sort of got the feeling that with the 12th Doctor comics that, well, they're playing it safe because he's the current Doctor on telly, and you've got to be very careful about what they do because they don't want it to change what's going to happen, and they can't really develop his character much because that's going to happen on telly, so that they've got a very small gap in which they can play with him in. Whereas this one, Paul Cornell seems to have got away with doing all sorts. I mean, we've got a future version of this Doctor, but then it's a multi-Doctor story, isn't it? And you can get away with murdering those anyway, because it'll all be retconned after it anyway, and they'll all have forgotten about it and they'll go back.
Yeah, they're even making a comment along those lines in this, oh, I'm not going to remember this, am I? You know?
No. So that could be it, really. But I think because of that, he's allowed to push it. And I think being able to push that, the Capaldi Doctor, is the key. And, you know, because, of course, he's the current Doctor as well on telly, it probably will have been, you know, in the contracts between BBC and Titan that he is the main Doctor out of these three in the strip. So, which he is taking that sort of leisure role. So he has to have some good meaty stuff to do, you know, because with the other two, you could end up doing anything you wanted with them. But I think that's probably how it's come about.
Yeah, for sure. And reading this issue, I still think it's a cut above what everyone else is doing, and I think you've put it really well why that is, this ability of him to do a lot more than the standard 12th Doctor. I think you got a raw deal, actually, with the 12th Doctor strip, because I think the first one you reviewed, that was it, the story set in India or with some Indian themes?
Pali.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was a real stinker. I'm just going to say.
They seem to struggle with him, I think. But it's, I think that's absolutely it. They can't. You're stuck with what you can do with him.
Yeah, that's right. All right, so we don't know where this is going to go. It could go absolutely anywhere. What are your thoughts overall on this particular issue?
I've got a little. I don't know if we've commented how good Paul Cornell's writing is. I've got a little bugbear with him in that. because I got to interview him before these comics went out about these comics.
That's
and
right.
One of my questions was about limitations on TV with the budgets. And does it make him want to, you know, push the boundaries in the comic of sets and planets and stuff? And in his answer to me, he was a bit cocky, I felt, and said there's not much they can't do on telly now, which is a load of rubbish, because I've been to talks with people like Mike Tucker about how effects are sorted out for the current series of Doctor Who. You know, in that scene we talked about with the War Doctor, where he graffitis a wall that has the Daleks exploding out of it. If that was had a dark sky behind it, for instance, so it was set at night, if it was set at daytime, it would have cost a lot more money to do. Because to generate a coloured sky on a computer will take longer than generating a dark sky.
Yeah.
So, you know, it still does have a budget, because these people who program the computers and draw the sets and things like that, if you want an intricate set, it's a few days' work. They get paid. You know, they've been paid a wage.
Yeah.
So, of course, it comes into it. So I didn't agree with what he said there. And I do feel that he doesn't always push the sets and the boundaries as far as he can. In the first issue, when they're in the jungle and Clara first goes to the computer thing, that's very much like a sort of small computer generated bit they would have at the beginning of one of the episodes. They've done it before like that, I'm sure. You know, especially River Song episodes where they saw the writing on the rock face or whatever it was.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
You know, you only see those, or the flying fish things at the end of the Rose's last episode. You know, you see it for a fleeting second because of the cost of it. Whereas in the comic, you don't have to go to these places for a fleeting second, you know. You can explore them more, you can be more intricate. You know, it's sort of... I think he is using boundaries of TV, and he doesn't push some of the places as much as he could.
Yeah. And that could be very deliberate. He might want to make it feel that it fits into the TV sort of scheme of things.
Yeah, he might do. But I just wanted to bring up that I didn't agree with him when he said that, and that, you know...
No, look, I get where you're coming from, because in comics you can and you should be able to do anything. It's infinite, and to be limited, it can be frustrating at times, I guess, to someone like you especially, who is very visual.
Yeah, well, that's my other issue, is a visual one. It's something I haven't noted who's done the artwork and the illustrations and things for this one. But I know early on when I was reviewing The Swords of Kali, one of my bugbears was that you could see, or I could see, some of the Photoshop tricks that had been used with stretching and cutting and pasting and things. Now, the artwork in this is miles above The Swords of Kali. It's beautiful artwork. It's really good, but, you know, especially buildings and, you know, and landscapes and things like that, you know, they're very well done. But there are certain panels in this issue where... especially there's one of David Tennant and there's one of Peter Capaldi where they look a little bit too muscular and wide. It's more chisel-jawed than they actually are. And I think that's because the image has been stretched slightly to fit. But it certainly doesn't look like them in some of the frames. There's a bit of continuity issues. And I'm pretty sure that that's come later on when they've been doing the layout and tweaking it.
Yeah, there are a few frames where the doctors just didn't look like themselves at all. Particularly Tennant, he looked like a completely different guy in some of them.
He does, yeah. He looks like there's a book called How to Draw the Marvel Way, and they have like a chisel-jawed Reed Richards type figure for you to learn from, and he looks very much like that in some shots.
Well, I'm just flicking back through the pages now. I did like the scene where they decide to make a break for it, cause a diversion. And the Tennant Doctor realizes that they have to keep him alive, so he leaps off the platform that they're standing on.
Ooh.
And I thought that was fairly true to form. I thought, you know, out of all of them, it was probably the Tennant Doctor who'd probably try something like that. Would you agree or disagree?
Yeah, I think he's got the characters of the Doctors spot on. Terence Dix has this... this quote when he's talking at conventions and things that, you know, he says when you're writing for the Doctor, you just write dialogue for the Doctor and let the actor do it.
Mm.
Whereas in the comic, you've got to work a bit harder. And this is, Paul Cornell did say this in the little interview, that you have to, you know, graft a bit harder to get the character of the Doctor out because he's been represented by artwork. And as we've just said, sometimes not necessarily the greatest artwork. So you really have to get the dialogue right and the characters of those Doctors right. And I think he has got those spot on. I think all three of the Doctors in it have done really well. And yeah, I think he has got, you know, exactly right. I mean, the other bit, the other Tennant bit was when he was getting so upset when he saw the timeline where he'd let Wilf die. And, you know, he was absolutely gutted at that because he would never do that. So yeah, he did. That's how his life ended. He sacrifices himself, doesn't he?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah,
and I think it was good that we saw the 10th and 11th Doctor doing things that they would never do. For example, not saving Wolf, because otherwise, I think this story with, you know, Capaldi being king of the Vord and, you know, being the way he is, it just wouldn't. It might not ring true. But then you can look back and say, well, look, in so many parallel universes, in infinite numbers of possibilities, at least somewhere there's a possibility it could happen, I guess.
Yeah. Maybe that's somewhere, maybe that'll come back in the conclusion then.
Hmm. Yeah.
You know, because he might put those in as clues for us, you know.
Oh, with Paul Cornell, it's hard to say. But he only does have one issue to wrap it all up, so he's going to have a lot to do, I think.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to look at it, won't it? Yeah,
it will, and indeed, it comes out 3 days after this episode of Who Wars goes out, but it'll be a good almost 2 weeks before we're all talking about it again. So
yeah, I'm quite excited for it now.
and again, I didn't think this issue was as interesting as the one before it, but it does set things up. There is still stuff in there to sort of latch onto. Very, very interesting stuff.
Now, if you think about some of the two-parter endings from the actual series, if you was to take this issue and the next issue as the final episode, then it probably does follow a similar sort of rhythm, because sometimes in those final episodes of a two-parter, there is a lot of padding at the beginning, building up to a conclusion. So if you was to take it as these two issues as the final one, then perhaps we've got something.
Hmm. You know, a thought's just come back to me to go back to the Doctor's parcel of comics. What if he's somehow hidden them in the artwork of a comic?
Yeah, that'd be brilliant.
And she opens the comic and somehow she gets zapped into the comic, or they come out of the comic, or something happens to do with the comic. Because it seems Paul Cornell's been weaving this comic theme through the whole story.
It does. And having said that as well, now, one thing that really caught my eye was... Issue 2 starts with some quirky artwork, doesn't it? They change the artwork style. Is it while Clara's describing what's happened?
I think
It's more like a kid's drawing of what I did on my holidays or something, isn't it?
That was Gabby Gonzalez. They've done that in some of the 10th... Yeah, they've done that in some of the 10th Doctor comics already, because she's keeping a diary.
Ah, right. Well, that's interesting as well, then, that's there.
Yeah, yeah.
But there is sort of a... Yeah, there's definitely... You know, and again, that'd be... That's Paul Cornell bringing his own world into it as well, isn't it, by featuring comic books and the fact that we're celebrating a year of the comic.
Exactly, yeah.
So it's probably even cleverer than we think. or otherwise, we've just stumbled upon a lot of coincidences, but I don't think they are.
Well, it's like when we watch Doctor Who week to week, and like when we start doing the review show. Some of the theories we're going to come out with on that, I think, will be quite out there.
Al's already got theories for this series, and Al doesn't let go of theories. He will weave it into every episode.
Well, speaking of, I threw an article up on the Who Wars Facebook page earlier today, and Al's already replied to that, saying, oh, yeah, they've got one of my theories listed there. Because it's an article about speculation and spoilers and things.
Yeah, well, I need to get in because I've got a couple of bits of speculation myself and I don't want anyone taking credit for them if I'm right.
You know? Oh, well, get them up.
I will.
All right, let's close this out. Overall, whether it's out of 5 or out of 10, what would be your sort of rating for this issue of the comic?
This actual individual issue, I have to try and break it away from the other three issues now, don't I?
You do. Yeah, you do almost need a sort of a overall score and a this issue score.
Well, I think mostly, in this one, I enjoyed I like the Vaud City as a drawing style. It could have been more ambitious, like I said, but it's actually very nicely drawn, and I'm very into perspective and building, so some things there thrilled me. And I do like the apparent death of a companion, because I'm grizzly. I think overall I'd probably give it a 3 out of 5.
Yeah.
That will score it 5.
Yep, I'd be in a similar area.
3 out of 5, yeah.
Yeah, 3 out of 5 for me too. But with the thought that it is going somewhere that could be a 4 out of 5 or even a 5 out of 5 in the next episode or issue.
Yeah, possibly. Yeah.
We will see. Well, thank you so much, Andy, for joining us.
Pleasure.
And we'll be back in a couple of weeks' time with, I don't know who's going to be reviewing issue number 5. We're going to try and get a few of us, at least more than 2, on to chat and talk about it all. And we will talk to you then. Bye-bye.
Bye.
So, I haven't exactly been thrilled with the last 2 issues of Titan's Doctor Who 10th Doctor series. So, has this new issue, number 13, changed my mind? Well, stay tuned and find out. So, like I said, this is issue number 13. It's called Spiral Staircase Part 1, which is kind of interesting because it's more like a Part 3. It's a continuation of the last 2 stories, so that's kind of different how they're numbering these. But we've got the same crew, Nick Abadzis, Elena Casagrande, and then Hi-Fi for the colorist, who you can hear me interview in the Phoenix Comic Con special, by the way. So there's a really interesting cover. It's got the Doctor in the foreground. He's trapped in some sort of ray shield with lightning and stuff. It kind of reminds me of when Count Dooku is holding Obi-Wan Kenobi captive, and he can't move or anything, and he's just kind of suspended. And then you got the girls, Gabby and Cindy, behind him, kind of like, they look kind of angry almost, like they're running towards him and yelling. And then they're all surrounded by just like rubble and ruins of the city. And the variant is pretty cool. It's the 10th Doctor standing right on the Brooklyn Bridge. So it's a photograph of the Brooklyn Bridge. So that's pretty cool. Now the main characters as featured on the inside cover are the Doctor, Gabby, and Dorothy Bell. Why don't I just go ahead and read the previously portion on here? It's pretty good. Leaving Gabby to make amends with Cindy, the Doctor discovered an unearthly device in the heart of Manhattan capable of triggering rejuvenation. The Doctor tracked the device to the apartment of actress Dorothy Bell, dogged every step of the way by street-smart Agent Cleo. Having seized the artifact at Bell's home, Cleo unleashed a fraction of its power before fleeing back to her employers, Eric and Hanif, leaving Dorothy, her assistant, Vivian, and the Doctor in a state of retro-regeneration. But the artifact restored more than a healthy, youthful glow to Dorothy. She merged with the mysterious alien entity within, and is now drawing a strange extraterrestrial power toward Earth. Okay, so I thought that was a really good recap, actually. It helped to clear a few things up in my mind, anyway, so that's kind of telling about the last few issues. So yeah, Dorothy's merged with this alien entity, and she's glowing, and she can fly now, and she apparently has the ability to use matter transmutation to rebuild things, and so she's kind of taken this mission upon herself to make things better as she sees fit. So the first thing she goes to fix is the hospital where they were going to build a wing in her honor. We find out the mysterious organization is actually a cult, and they are awaiting the ascension, and they're just, they don't really know what's going on, but they are expecting some sort of god or something to return, and there's going to be this ascension, they believe. Eventually, this mysterious organization, they join forces with the Doctor, and they chase down Dorothy. In the meantime, Dorothy has really taken a liking to Gabby, and she actually, like, takes her and flies off with her. And so she decides that the Empire State Building needs about 20 more floors. So she transmutates the Empire State Building, and eventually she just kind of goes on this spree of fixing the whole city. And it's just, like, total chaos, and, you know, there's even one of the Hallmark Doctor Who news stories talking about all this rebuilding going on in the town and what's happening and blah, blah, blah. And in the midst of all this chaos, you see that mysterious dark spaceship has actually landed in New York. And the last frame we see is the Doctor and Cindy actually disappearing. And then it's to be continued. So yeah, I thought this issue was pretty interesting. Probably about the same level as the last one. A little more than two issues ago. But, you know, we get to find out a little more about some of this stuff. But still, it's like so mysterious. And it's kind of driving me crazy because I like to know things. Hopefully, we'll find out even more in the next issue. Who's behind the spaceship? Who exactly is Cleo? More about this alien entity that's merged with Dorothy. If by the end of this story arc we don't find out more answers, I'm going to be really upset. Now, the art, yeah, I don't really have anything bad to say about the art. It's kind of some interesting scenes with New York City because they look a little bit just, rather than just traditionally painted or whatever, they look kind of, you know, maybe just filtered in Photoshop. So it would have been kind of nice maybe to have that more consistent. And one thing I did like was the lettering. And so special shout out to the letterers, Richard Starkings and Comic Crafts Jimmy Bentecourt. I really liked the lettering because, you know, with Dorothy and the merged entity, it was different text for when they were talking. So you could tell who was saying what. Okay, so like when she's at the hospital and she's getting ready to do the remodeling. So Dorothy says, "Let's do it the way I've always wanted it done." So there's this other little bubble with different text. And I imagine it would sound something like this. "Enhancements in progress." And so I thought that was just a really neat way to differentiate the different speech patterns from these characters, even though they're merged into one. So that was pretty cool. Overall, I'll give this 7 Sonic Screwdrivers out of 10. I think that's what I gave the last issue. It was about pretty similar to that. So let's hope for the Spiral Staircase Part 2 that it really picks up and we get some more answers. That's what I'm hoping for. All right. Later, guys. Allons-y, and may the Force be with you.
Hey there everyone, it's me back with another NSA review. What are the NSAs? If you've not been reading them, they're the new series adventures, or a series of Doctor Who novels that began back when Christopher Eccleston was the Doctor, replacing the Eighth Doctor range from BBC Books, so that the current TV Doctor could have his own series of novels. And if you've heard one of my recent back page sections where I talked about my life with Doctor Who novels, I spoke about how the NSAs had largely passed me by. I'd been ignoring them. I've never read an NSA with the Ninth Doctor in it, or the Tenth Doctor, or the Eleventh Doctor. I have heard some of the BBC audiobooks, which were quite good, but these novels I've not got into. And it was going that way as well for the Peter Capaldi Doctor NSAs until just recently. I picked up the first three, all in hardback, lovely little books, and I believe the next three are about to be released, or have been released, so I should catch up with those as well. And the first of those I reviewed recently on Who Wars, called The Blood Cell, and you might remember I was talking about how I'd been waiting to read a new Doctor Who novel, and I was expecting a traditional Doctor Who story, but The Blood Cell was written in the first person and was a little different to a regular Doctor Who story, so it's not until this book, called Silhouette, that I've gotten to read a traditional, straight down the line, Doctor Who novel. So, what do I think of it? Well, I guess the best place to start is the back of the book. If you're in a bookstore, you know, what are they? I guess most people don't go to bookstores anymore. But if you're in a bookstore or you're online, you might read the back of the book. And the back of the book runs thus: Marlow Hapworth is found dead in his locked study, killed by an unknown assailant. This is a case for the great detective Madame Vastra. Rick Bellamy, bare-knuckle boxer, has the life drawn out of him by a figure dressed as an undertaker. This angers Strax the Sontaran. The Carnival of Curiosities, a collection of bizarre and fascinating sideshows and performers. This is where Jenny Flint looks for answers. How are these things connected? And what does Orestes Milton, rich industrialist, have to do with it all? As the Doctor and Clara join the hunt for the truth, they find themselves thrust into a world where nothing and no one are what they seem. Now, the first thing I'll say about that blurb on the back of the book is parts of it seemed a bit childish, you know. Oh, this is happening, it's a job for Vastra. This is happening, it's a job for Strax. This is happening, it's a job for Jenny. And yes, those characters are in the book, and yes, those characters investigate those things, but that kind of gives a weird sort of vibe to what the book is like. It's not quite like that at all. It really does feature a lot of the Doctor and Clara. The Paternoster gang are there for, you know, support and comic relief and all the things they do on the television. Even that last line about them being thrust into a world where nothing and no one are what they seem. Yes, you can justify that by what happens in Silhouette, but it's just sort of lazy copywriting. It's just sort of a silly way of expressing things there. I think that could have been better done. So if you're relying on the blurb on the back of the book, trust me, the book is better than that. Having said that, though, I wasn't quite sure whether I was enjoying myself or not when I started reading Silhouette. It's kind of hard to explain, but I was, you know, turning the pages thinking, yes, this is a Doctor Who adventure. Yes, there's the Doctor. He's doing stuff. But it wasn't quite clicking with me at first. But eventually it shook itself out and I got on with things. So if you start reading this in a chapter or two and you're wondering, where's it all going? What's this all about? Don't worry, it gets better. The basic premise of the book, and, you know, a few spoilers here, mild ones at least, is that Orestes Milton is a weapons dealer and he's being hunted by the Shadow Proclamation. He's laying low in Victorian London with some of his weapons, and his weapons are real people who he's weaponized by augmenting their DNA to enhance abilities they already have, but to a much more heightened state, and we'll get to that a little more in a moment. I've got to say, the title of the book is confusing. It's called Silhouette, but Silhouette isn't the main enemy. That's Orestes Milton. And to my mind, she's not even a main character for most of the book. She does do something useful right at the end, but does that warrant the whole book being named after her? You know, I know it sounds like a dramatic title, Silhouette, and you get to put this beautiful Victorian woman on the cover in a cape and everything, but the novel's not really about her. She is in the novel, don't get me wrong, but I just didn't get the sense that she really deserved the novel being named after her. Indeed, out of the characters that Orestes Milton has under his thumb through changing their DNA to become these weapons, she doesn't even have the most interesting power. Affinity, whose original name was Alfie, and he's a showman from the Frost Fair that they've all been attending earlier in the book, can change his face to be someone that you'll have, well, an affinity with, hence the name. And he becomes a young man that Jenny warms to, and he becomes a different young man that Clara warms to, and he even changes into a Silurian that Vastra naturally attaches herself to, thinking, oh, look, I'm not the last Silurian after all, and that leads her to be captured very easily at one point in the book. It's a really interesting character affinity, and there's even an interesting scene where he meets up with the Doctor, and he cycles through being all the past Doctors, thinking these are all different people, of course, because that's what you would think, that are meaningful to the Doctor without realizing the truth about who they are. So we get a little section in Silhouette where we have past Doctors, as it were, interacting with Capaldi. But of course, they're not past Doctors. They're just Affinity changing his appearance. That was a very cool scene. And again, Affinity, I think, has a much cooler ability than Silhouette, who was a sort of a shadow puppeteer and now can, you know, using telepathy, can make little flying origami birds attack people and things like that. It's kind of interesting and such, but it's not quite as cool as Affinity. Why wasn't the book called Affinity? I don't know. Anyway, the climax of the book, which I'll skip to now, is very well done. It's very Doctor Who. The bad guy being given a choice and thinking he's too clever by half chooses the wrong option, which leads to his downfall, which ultimately came by his own hand. You know, it doesn't get much more of a Doctor Who ending than that. So, overall, after some initial misgivings, I did quite enjoy this book. I know the Paternoster gang's not to everyone's liking, and truly Strax in particular gets on my nerves as much as he makes me laugh at times. I like Victorian London, so the city and the fun fair that they've been at and the side streets and the alleyways all combine to paint a setting that I really enjoy reading fiction in general. Characterisation is on form. I guess this book was even written before Capaldi's first outing as the Doctor, but it manages to just capture him really well. Likewise Clara, although there'd obviously been some source material for that, and likewise the Paternoster gang. So if I had to give it a score, probably a solid 3 out of 5 for me. I'd recommend reading it if you like Victorian London and or the Paternoster gang in particular, because they are such a part of the story, both the environment and the characters. And I guess the last thing to say is, if you have read Silhouette, what did you think of it? Why not write into hello@whowars.net and tell me all about it, and we'll use your comments on a future episode. I always love a bit of late mail during the production process, and while I've been putting together this episode, Andy has submitted some material to Kate on Coming to Who Wars and his favourite moments and such over the past year, and I've looked at Kate's piece that she had already put together, and I couldn't see a way to put Andy's comments in there, so I think it might stand as a very interesting little piece in its own right on Andy's time with the show. So here to bookend this episode, we had Kate's at the start, let's finish off with Andy's thoughts on this past year. Thank you so much, Andy, for sending this in.
Hello, hello, hello. Andy here, or as I was known back then, the Rev. Gosh, how we've changed. When I first joined the Who Wars team, I was hoping to make some exciting documentaries and features, but it wasn't long before I was being given tasks to do by Rob. Gosh, he's a taskmaster, is Rob. He didn't have to make you graft. Anyway, I started reviewing the Darth Vader comic, which is great. I love Darth Vader, but I've got a low attention span. Ooh, Twiglets! Oh, sorry. I've got a low attention span and thought I'd do a little bit more than just the normal kind of review. So one week, I dramatised one of the scenes from the comic. Little did I know that that was going to lead to some exciting times and an exciting partnership. When Dr. Aphra was introduced to the Darth Vader comic, it wasn't long before I needed to cast somebody to help me with the reviews. And that's when I started working with Kate. I always thought I'd be doing solo features on the Who Wars podcast, but it turns out that Kate's a lot of fun and loved the Darth Vader comic as much as I did, and was as up for being daft and doing silly voices as I was.
Dr. Aphra, I have need of you.
Of course, I also got the opportunity to do many little documentaries and features about Doctor Who and Star Wars, and I'm really, really pleased with the two features I did exploring the psychology of Princess Leia and Darth Vader and what makes them tick and what makes them the people they are. And just getting an opportunity to explore those characters a little bit deeper and look at them from a different point of view that doesn't often get explored. When Rob asked me to interview Kevin Scott, writer of Titans Doctor Who comic, little did I know that that was going to be the beginning of something very exciting. If I could have gone back in time to 8-year-old me and said, you know what, Andrew, one day you are going to have your own chat show talking to people who are from Doctor Who. Like the ones on the telly, but all the guests will be from Doctor Who. I would have probably believed myself. But little did I know that other people would be interested, and little did I know it would be so amazing to get some of the guests that I've managed to get when I've approached them. Not only all the Titan comic people and the illustrators and writers who've told me about so many exciting projects other than the Doctor Who stuff and given me a real good insight, but actual heroes of mine. Dominic Glynn, the composer, was an absolute favourite interview. He let me intersperse it with pieces of music, and he really was eloquent in the way he described and talks about things. That was a really, really fun interview, which I had to do after midnight because he's a night owl, because he's a DJ. So that was a very strange situation to be in, but great fun. Matt Ervin was a childhood hero. He used to pop up on Saturday morning kids TV showing K9 and how he worked, and he'd be showing models and things. I got to talk to him. I think the interview ended up being about 50 minutes on Who Was, but I think I've got about 2.5 hours worth of footage because he's a chatterbox. Some of that did involve him really specifically wanting a certain version of the Tomorrow's World theme tune being played, and he was so adamant that I played the right version that he went wanting to get the CD. And there's a bit of the interview that isn't broadcast where you hear him run upstairs, rummage around in a room, and you can hear swearing and cupboards and CDs being thrown about, and then he stomps back down the stairs and he puts it in the machine upside down because it's a special CD and you can't tell which side is which. And yeah, what a great character, what an amazing fella, and I had the joy of meeting him in the flesh a week later and having a chat about things. So yeah, some great interviews. But hang on, there was another fella, weren't there? Colin Baker. I still can't quite believe that I got to interview a man who played the Doctor on telly. I won't say it's my favourite interview, because it was very stressful, because I was doing it live on stage in front of an audience at a Comic-Con, Hull Comic-Con, and I had to get that right and make sure they were entertained, so I was focused on that. But also the recording went badly, and the version that was broadcast was made up from three different people's recordings, some bits of my own, plus a couple of people in the crowd, not least Fan in the Bath, who came across to this podcast with me as my groupie. I hope you're listening, Fan in the Bath. But yeah, what can I say? I got to interview some great people.
Thanks so much for that piece, Andy. You reminded me of a few great times on Who Wars over the last 40 episodes as well. And together with Kate's piece and just conversations I've had with the Who Wars team in general, it's clear to me that all of us have managed to grow in different ways over the last year or so, whether we were coming to Who Wars as people who had already made podcasts or people who had never made podcasts, people who had done interviews, people who had never done interviews. I think all of us have got something out of the experience, and as we look towards 2016 and some new plans, which of course the Who Wars team will know about as they hear me mention them here, and which the listeners will find out about very soon, maybe even in the next episode, it's clear to me that we've got together a real special team of people, and we have a lot of fun making this, and the fun is going to continue in the future. Maybe not in the same format as Who Wars as you know it today, but maybe I'm already saying too much. Alright, let's get into some closing credits. Well, here we are at the end of the 40th Who Wars. I wonder how many minutes of entertainment that makes now. We kicked off on, what was it, 4,014 minutes plus this episode. We're now on 4,000 and whatever it is. My thanks, as always, to the team for putting together such great material, and of course to you out there for listening to it, whether you're listening to it in the week the episode came out or whether you're listening to it a year from now or who knows, many years from now. Depends how long we keep this feed running, I guess. One thing I will mention here is we didn't have a Clone Wars review this episode. I simply didn't have time to watch any Clone Wars this week, so my apologies in the name of getting out the episode on time in its usual 5 p.m. Australian Eastern Standard Time slot. We just haven't had time to put it together. Apologies. Now, we have a listener email to go through. I'm just pulling it up now on the Who Wars computer. And it's from John Hull, Johnna Holler on Twitter, who's written to us before. Hello, John. He says, "Hi, Rob. Hope you're well. Sorry, here's a long email because you got me thinking again." Well, that's okay, John. I don't mind long emails at all. "On the subject of being loyal to George Lucas, when talking about Star Wars to people since the prequels came out, I've always tried to speak in defense of his work. point number one changes. The main gripe with the special editions is in some ways valid, but there are more good changes than bad, such as the substitution of the alien language for English and Vader's lightsaber being coloured in after Luke blasts the doors on the Death Star in Episode 4. On the subject, there is still a mad bit in Episode 4 that I don't think anyone has ever mentioned. It's just a second, but halfway through the film there is a bit where Vader is clearly talking to Tarkin and his hands are moving, etc., but you can't hear anything. Mad. Always bothered me. It's still there on the Blu-ray. Number 2, the second major gripe is Phantom Menace. I love it, but it's a different film to all the others, isn't it? Jar Jar is fine, but he does remind me of Forrest Gump towards the end, which is what annoys me. A bumbling clown succeeding due to luck rather than being ingenious or brave. I don't find that satisfying. But it's fun in a different way to all the others and possibly has the best music. Number 3, CGI. People always mention CGI when they have a moan about Phantom Menace, but if you watch the extras, you'll see there was quite a few models made for it, and they're brilliant. Sadly, the other two have too much, but people don't seem to mention that. When he sold up to Disney, I did think of the stuff he didn't write or create which informed what he did. I often wondered how much involvement he had in the other stuff, things like Expanded Universe games, Timothy Zahn novels, Ewok and Droids cartoons, comics. Will this be better managed under Disney's new canon? And on the subject of what he didn't create, he took Coruscant from Timothy Zahn novels and numerous stuff here, and he's provided a link for me. I'll throw that into the show notes. Also, for Episode 7, Kylo Ren, and from Droids, Kybo Ren. Similar names, eh? Perhaps it's Ben Burtt's influence again. Well, maybe. Number 4, abuse. I wonder if anyone is built for the millions of insults that have been thrown at him since fans discovered the internet. He's quite a sensitive introvert, some say. I often think of the scene from Spaced where Simon Pegg is shouting at a kid. He nails how daft the situation is. And again, I've been given a link here. I'll throw that into the show notes. As for the future, Kathleen Kennedy is a perfect choice to fill the shoes in many ways. When I saw the little trailer for the making of Episode 7 some months back, I did feel a bit sad that it was J.J. Abrams on set and not Lucas. It's a bit like your favourite band with a different drummer. Or maybe Lucas would be on keyboards. Like New Order without Peter Hook, Blink-182 without Tom DeLonge. And also that quote where Lucas said that Disney discarded his ideas. I really want to see those notes, I don't know about you. In some ways, I hope he's lying so he doesn't have to talk about it, and they kept all his good, crazy, inventive stuff. I think Guardians of the Galaxy had more of the classic feel of the trilogy that fans of the original trilogy have been missing. I'm hoping it'll be like that. To me, also, Force 10 from Navarone from 1978, also featuring Harrison Ford, has some of that too. I think there's the outnumbered Motley Crue against the enemy boys adventure thing that we also enjoy from Star Wars. The forming of the Empire wasn't a better story. Lucas knew that. That's why he started with the best bit. As for Rogue One, it doesn't seem right to have a Star Wars film with no spiritual Jedi stuff to me. Did you see Red Tails? I really liked it. It should have been a bigger hit. It's a shame Strange Magic failed. I feel Lucas deserved to go out on a hit. But it's not all about the films. He changed the movie industry in so many ways, and we are richer for his involvement, whether it's Pixar or Indiana Jones or the THX sound system thing. Anyway, thanks for the podcast. I was going to record myself reading this, but I quite like hearing what I sound like with an Australian accent. If I tried, it might sound as bad as JR of the Blue Box podcast. From John. Well, thank you, John, and you raised so many things there. I won't try and address each and every one of them. I'll just cherry pick out a few pet topics of mine. The first, if we're working backwards, is Red Tails. I haven't actually seen it, and that's weird because I do like World War II movies. I like World War I movies as well. I like movies with planes in them, and it makes no sense that I haven't seen it, but I haven't actually seen it. You've reminded me now that it exists. I'll have to go out there and grab the Blu-ray or the DVD or whatever I can find. Strange Magic as well. That it seemed to come out with no fanfare. In fact, it had sort of come and gone before I knew what was happening, that George Lucas had been involved with this film, and it's been and gone. It's so strange that Red Tails and Strange Magic, despite the Lucas influence, just didn't go anywhere. Isn't that weird? As for Rogue One, I've got to disagree. It's the lack of Jedi stuff in Rogue One that is really attracting me to it. the Star Wars universe has always seemed so much bigger to me than just Jedi, because to me, Jedi are a very small number of people in the overall universe. There might be Jedi numbering in the thousands in a universe of billions and billions and, you know, even more than that, you know. They are such a tiny minority that to always be telling stories and looking at stories where the Jedi are involved, to me, always seemed a little unrealistic. It may be interesting and it may be fun to see Jedi fighting. I get all of that, don't get me wrong. But thinking about it in practical terms, there would be far, far, far more stories to tell that don't involve any Jedi influence at all, simply because Jedi just aren't out there and as numerous as all that. So I actually like the idea of some Star Wars stories that don't necessarily have Jedi in them, because to me that's telling more of what's going on in the universe, and you really don't have a Jedi on every street corner, and every little gang of people doesn't have a Jedi in it. You know, that's just unrealistic. So I'm actually really looking forward to Rogue One in particular. In terms of Disney throwing away Lucas's ideas, yes, that was sad. I mean, I did speak about it on Who Wars at some stage. I couldn't even think to tell you what episode it might be, probably one of the earlier episodes. And I do remember, you know, some lovely black and white photography of Abrams and Lucas meeting, and I think they're having lunch or something. And there did seem to be sort of a real collaborative approach that Lucas had given them. You know, here's what I thought for the future episodes, and they would pull from them. But I don't know whether they sat down and looked at them and thought, oh no, if we make this, it'll be more, you know, Trade Federation type stuff and deep and meaningful stuff that doesn't translate well to, you know, modern movies like the prequels turned out to be, and we just have to change this, or whether the ideas were perfectly good and someone else might have had a bit of ego and thought, no, I want this to be the story because this is my story, and if Lucas isn't involved, we don't have to use his ideas. It's really hard to say. I don't know if the full truth will ever come out. It seems in Hollywood people sort of love to cover their ass quite a bit, and they never quite tell the full truth. Even when people do tell the truth, I think there's always three or four sides to every story, so who knows? Regarding CGI, I quite agree. There was a ton of real practical effects used in Episode 1, and in fact, when that video came out recently, you know, about Episode 7, and I think Mark Hamill was narrating, and he was saying, you know, practical effects, oh, look at this, it's so awesome. I was sitting there with, you know, many other people who know their Star Wars, and thinking, well, that's kind of rude, because although the later prequels did have a lot of CGI, and people did get annoyed that, you know, everything seemed to be filmed against a blue screen, Episode 1 in particular did have an awful lot of practical effects, you know, tons and tons of full-size ships and models and all sorts of stuff. So I quite enjoyed when people used to get on Twitter in past weeks and sort of, you know, tweet about, you know, all the practical effects from Episode 1, just to point out that although Episode 7 is trying to, you know, smooth the way for itself and say, oh, look, we're doing this all the old school way and it's not like the prequels is the underlying message. No, the prequels did have their share of practical effects too, particularly Episode 1. So you are spot on there, John. And finally, the changes that Lucas made to the original movies. Yes, I think a lot of the changes were great. I mean, you mentioned, you know, colouring Darth Vader's lightsaber during Episode 4. They used to call that the white saber, because it sounds like lightsaber and it was also white. It actually survived through at least a couple of special editions, I think, before it was actually coloured in. You can go back to some of the earlier special editions and it is still a white saber. Eventually it got coloured in red. One that I always think of in particular is in the scenes on Hoth in the snow speeders, because they were filming not with the blackness of space behind the ships but with a blue sky essentially. They had to turn down the translucency, I'm not really putting this very well, of the ships, and you can actually see through the cockpit. You know, it's meant to be a solid construct, but you can see through it because of the way they've had to film it, and they fixed that for these special editions, and I thought that was a great change too. Even things like, and I know this is a more controversial one, Cloud City, where Cloud City was just like one big, you know, 1970s BBC set for the original films, and then for the special edition they cut out some windows and you could see, you know, beautiful clouds outside Cloud City and ships flying past and things. I thought that really enhanced it, and I think if they had the technology at the time, they would have genuinely done that. On the flip side, there are things that I'm not as into. I mean, when Luke and Obi-Wan fly in, drive in to Mos Eisley in A New Hope, and you've got all the things going on, and there's that pullback, and you see the tiny little land speeder going into this massive, you know, city. That sort of destroys what Mos Eisley was to me. To me, Mos Eisley was much smaller. Mos Eisley was like a little outpost in a western. You know, it was a few streets with a few low buildings and a cantina. And that's the vibe that Mos Eisley always used to give me. I used to think of it as a western. And to suddenly have it as this more bustling, vibrant city, it kind of detracted for me. So, for me, not all the changes were good. They kind of changed the vibe of things. I think in Empire Strikes Back, for example, where Darth Vader asks Luke to join him, and Luke just looks at him, and in the original film, just coldly looks at him, steps off the gantry and falls to what he thinks will be his death. Very stoic, silent, beautiful. And in the special editions, if you pull out your Blu-ray, as Luke's falling, he goes, whoa, you know, like some sort of weird Bill and Ted sort of sound. You know, you almost expect there to be a dude on him, like, whoa, dude. It just really takes me out of the moment. Whereas Luke fell silently before, now he falls with this silly sound going on, this silly shout. It just doesn't do it for me. So thank you again, John, for your email. It certainly gave me a lot to talk about here, and I'll probably only make a brief little comment now for my back page section. I guess what we've had this week is Force Friday, and a lot of you out there, a lot of Who Wars listeners, even members of the Who Wars team, have been tweeting it up. You know, I'm off to the shop at midnight to do Force Friday and so on, and it's got me thinking, and I'll talk more about this in episode 41, actually, for a very particular reason, and you'll hear that when we get to episode 41. But for me, it started to highlight why elements of Star Wars under Disney just aren't for me, it seems. This whole vibe of it's midnight, it's Force Friday, so you've got to go out and buy the toys, but the toys themselves aren't limited in any way. Why do you have to be there at midnight? I don't understand that. You know, people are waving, I got Kylo Ren, and I got, you know, Rey, and I got this other action figure. Yippee. Well, fantastic. But you do know they're not limited in any way. They will be there on the shelves next week, and the week after, and the month after. And you know, in 10 years' time, you'll still be able to buy them for very little markup, if any. So, this whole marketing thing, where Disney is saying, it's Force Friday, go out and buy the toys, and people in this really Pavlovian way just react and go, oh, yes, we'll do that. It's really hard to talk about, because I know there are people out there who love doing it, and as I mentioned, there's even Who Wars team members who went out and did do it, and if I sort of slag it off here, you might feel that I'm slagging you off, or how you feel off, and that's not what I'm doing at all, because I am talking on a very personal level about how this Force Friday thing and the wider marketing that's going along about Star Wars at the moment, it just isn't me. It just isn't me, and I'm wondering whether I need to, you know, really step away from Star Wars to some degree and have a more personal kind of fandom with it, because although I can absolutely see that, you know, Force Friday and things give other people pleasure, and imagine if you're a kid, wow, wouldn't Force Friday be unreal, being taken to a store late at night and being able to choose a brand new action figure. I remember what it was like being taken by my mum in particular to go and buy a new Star Wars action figure. It was very exciting, and getting to flick through all the cards and trying to choose, you know, one out of however many there were on the shelf. I remember what that's like, and I don't begrudge anyone being excited by it, or particularly kids going along and doing that sort of thing. But for me, at this point in my life, it's just, I just can't get into it. It's like I'm getting older. Anyway, I will talk about this more in episode 41. I do have more to say, but I can see how long this back page has run already with John's extra long email. So I might leave it there for this episode. One thing I will say, though, is when I made a few comments on Twitter this past week about Force Friday and so on, some people did comment back to me and said that they sort of felt the same. And indeed, I even saw some memes regarding Force Friday, which did sort of highlight this whole commercial nature of them. It's, I mean, if I had to put it into a few words, it's just like this orgy of buying stuff because there's stuff. I don't know if that's a cynical way for me to look at it, but it's how it's come across to me. It's how I felt, and I've felt a bit, you know, a bit sidelined by Star Wars in recent times because of this this hype that's going on, and it's only going to get more intense over the next few months, and that really bothers me to some degree. I don't know if any of you feel the same. If you do, why not write in and tell me what you think, because next episode I will talk about this topic in greater detail and in greater length, and I'll probably be far more eloquent with it. And if you have some thoughts, I can maybe wheedle those thoughts into what I'm saying as well, because I do think this is a topic that doesn't affect everyone. I'm sure there are loads of people out there, probably the majority of people out there, who are just completely energized and excited by the marketing for Star Wars, but I'm not. And whether you are or aren't, why not write in and tell me all about it? Tell me how you're feeling about Star Wars in the Disney era and all the marketing and things that we're seeing surrounding it. All right, I think that wraps it up now for episode 40. That was a long back page, and I didn't even really say all that much. So tune into episode 41, where you'll hear me far more eloquent and far more focused. And without any further ado, thank you all for listening. You're always very welcome at Who Wars. Episode 40 in the can. Who Wars, 1 year anniversary. Who would have thought we'd ever make it? Wow.
Well, that wraps it up for another episode of Who Wars. If you'd like to be in touch with the show, simply email hello@whowars.net. Find us on Twitter @WhoWars, or if Facebook's more your thing, at facebook.com/WhoWars. Oh, and don't forget to leave us a rating on iTunes. See you next time.